The Interrogations. The new series of Political Thinking with me, Nick Robinson, starts on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds on Saturday evening at 5:30.
This is Radio 4 on 92 to 95 FM on BBC Sounds and your smart speaker.
Hello, it's 6 o'clock on Monday the 2nd of September. This is Today with Michelle Hussain and Amol Rajan.
The headlines this morning: the outstanding to inadequate one or two word grading system for schools in England is being scrapped ahead of a new report card system next September. The Education Secretary Bridget Phillipson will be with us live to explain. A nationwide strike is beginning in Israel after protests and anger at the government after the deaths of more hostages. We'll talk to the daughter of one man still held in Gaza.
Also in today's programme, yesterday Great Britain celebrated their most successful day at a Paralympic Games this century.
It's going to end with a gold. Gold for Great Britain. It is a fifth gold in the velodrome for the British paracyclists. A 14th medal. A table-topping effort.
We'll speak to two gold medalists about that record-breaking Super Sunday, and Sir Ian McKellen will be joining us live at about 8:20 to talk about his recovery from a fall off stage and his new film, The Critic, and how at the age of 85 he's going to continue treading the boards for quite
just keep
time.
At it as long as the legs and the lungs and the mind keep working.
But first, the BBC News is read by Tom Sanders.
The government has scrapped one- or two-word Ofsted ratings for state schools in England. It says they don't provide a fair assessment of overall performance. The decision comes 8 months after an inquest found that an inspection that judged a primary school in Berkshire as inadequate contributed to the suicide of its head teacher, Ruth Perry. The change has been criticised by the Conservatives, who say it removes a vital indicator for parents. Here's our education editor, Bramwen Jeffries.
From today, no school in England will be issued with a single overall grade, such as outstanding or inadequate, following an Ofsted inspection. The inspection standards will remain the same, and the reports will still grade areas such as quality of education, behaviour and leadership. A new report card system will be developed by September 2025. The family of Ruth Perry has been calling for the change. Her sister, Julia Waters, told the BBC they were delighted, particularly Ruth's teenage daughters, and it was a relief no other head teacher would go through a similar experience. MPs had also called for the one- or two-word grades to be replaced after hearing that Ofsted had lost the trust of the teaching profession. Education unions welcomed the scrapping of grades they said were crude and damaging.
Israel is bracing for a general strike called by trade unions and groups representing the families of Israeli hostages. They aim to force ministers to reach a deal to free those still held by Hamas in Gaza. Our correspondent John Donison reports from Jerusalem.
After last night's protests, the biggest seen in Israel since the start of the war, with hundreds of thousands demonstrating across the country, today a general strike. Thousands of businesses will be closed, some schools, universities and government ministries. A forum representing some hostage families has called for more demonstrations across Israel today, with plans to block the country's busiest roads. The outrage at Hamas is a given, but these protests are not about that. The anger is directed at the government of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who is accused of blocking a ceasefire and hostage release deal to prioritise his own personal political survival. Mr. Netanyahu rejects this. He says it is Hamas which is blocking a deal and insists they will be pursued and brought to account.
AfD has become the first far-right party to win a regional election in Germany since the Second World War. It's won the most seats in the parliament of the eastern state of Thuringia, though the other mainstream parties say they won't lend it the support it needs to form a government there. The AfD came a close second in polls taking place in the neighbouring state of Saxony. MPs return to Parliament from their summer recess today. Ministers are promising a packed agenda, including votes this week on legislation to nationalise the railways. Sir Keir Starmer will also face his first Prime Minister's questions since the government decided to scrap winter fuel payments for millions of pensioners. Our political correspondent Nick Eardley reports.
The government is promising to get on with the job as Parliament returns, with a pledge of a packed legislative agenda. There will be votes in the Commons this week on bills to require independent oversight of big financial policies and to bring rail companies into public ownership over time. There is, however, no escaping doom-laden messages from ministers about the state of the public finances. Some Labour MPs fear the government has been too negative in its messaging over the summer. There's also concern among Labour MPs about the decision to remove winter fuel support for millions of pensioners not on pension credit.
A new vaccine to protect babies and elderly people from a cold virus is now available on the NHS across the UK. It's hoped the rollout could help ease pressure on hospitals in the winter. Officials say tackling the virus, known as RSV, could be a game changer. Here's our health correspondent, Sophie Hutchinson.
It's estimated that 20,000 babies are hospitalised in England each year with illnesses linked to RSV, and up to 30 die as a result. The virus also affects elderly people and contributes to 9,000 hospital admissions for pneumonia each year. The new vaccine will be offered to women who are at least 28 weeks pregnant and people aged 75 to 79 years in all parts of the UK from today.
An expedition to the wreck of the Titanic has found that a large section of the railing on the bow has fallen to the sea floor as a result of the ship's erosion by salt water and microbes. The discovery was made during a series of dives by underwater robots this summer. The search also found a bronze statue that once adorned the first-class lounge lying face up amongst the debris surrounding the wreck.
Tom, thank you very much indeed. More from you shortly. It is 6 minutes past six. Time to say good morning to the BBC Weather Centre and Elizabeth Riccini. Morning, Elizabeth.
Good morning back, Emma. Well, it was very warm yesterday. It was 30 degrees Celsius in Wigan Holt in West Sussex. We had some thunderstorms, of course, further west, and we're still in that very humid air mass as we head through most of today. It's a warm and a muggy start. Temperatures at 19 degrees Celsius at the moment in parts of southern England. We will eventually see fresher feeling conditions across the board through the day tomorrow. But for today, well, there's still that Met Office weather warning in force for thunderstorms all day. The greatest chance of those will be across Wales, the Midlands, Northern England and central and eastern areas of Scotland. But of course, the thunderstorms are very hit or miss. Many places will escape them altogether. There's a lot of low cloud and mist around through the morning, very poor visibility, plenty of coastal and hill fog that could linger on through the day, and there'll be a lot of low cloud around for much of the day too. For Northern Ireland, well, some rain to start, plenty of low cloud, but by the end of the afternoon, a fresher feel to things with some sunny spells. For Scotland, low cloud with some widespread showers, best of any brightness in the far south and east. For England and Wales, a very messy picture, a few early thunderstorms tracking northwards, some showers, cloud and patchy rain, but also some sunny spells breaking through, especially through the afternoon. It's still warm and muggy in the far south and the east. Gentle to moderate winds across the board. Temperatures 15 to 18 Celsius in the north and the west, but for the far south and the east, we could get to 25 or 26 degrees Celsius still.
Elizabeth, thank you very much. 8 minutes past six. Let us turn to what's in the papers this morning. And photographs of the six Israeli hostages found dead in Gaza make the front pages of The Times, The Guardian and The Financial Times. Their discovery has led to what The Guardian calls an eruption of public outrage against the Israeli government for its failure to reach a deal to bring the remaining hostages back. Frustration among relatives has, according to The Financial Times, become more intense because of the realisation that time is running out for the 101 hostages still held. The Times says protests and the prospect of a general strike are increasing the pressure on the Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu.
The decision to scrap one-word Ofsted judgments for the state sector in England is described by Metro as a grade big U-turn on use on schools. The Daily Telegraph reports that the change has been introduced so swiftly that the exact form of the new report cards has not been decided. The paper understands they could be at-a-glance sheets no bigger than A4. Another week, another win for the union, says The Sun, adding in its editorial, teachers have got their way. And I should just say, we've got Amanda Spielman, former head of Ofsted, coming on in about an hour's time. And at 8:10, Michelle's interviewing Bridget Phillipson, the Education Secretary.
Germany's far right has first big win since Nazis, is the Times' lead on the electoral success for the AfD party in regional elections in Thuringia and Saxony. The Guardian says the results have sent shockwaves through the political landscape. But according to the Financial Times, what has happened is a reflection of mounting frustration among many East Germans against a government that they associate with high inflation, economic stagnation, surging energy costs and constant internecine squabbling. The Telegraph reckons that Olaf Scholz's days as Chancellor are numbered.
The Daily Mirror reports that almost 60 children a day were suspended from school for racism last year. In all, 11,619 pupils were sent home in 2023. That's an increase of 25% on the previous 12 months. Campaigners claim impressionable children are repeating what they hear from their parents and right-wing figures in the media, and indeed social media. The Department for Education says racism and discrimination has no place in schools.
Ludicrous is the Daily Express's take on the claim by the Commons leader that the government cut universal winter fuel payments for pensioners to prevent a run on the pound. The Shadow Treasury Minister Laura Trott has described Lucy Powell's remarks as ridiculous fantasies. The Sun's political editor Harry Cole calls the remarks gibberish. Ms Powell said she was really sorry that the government had been forced to make the decision, but said ministers had been left with no choice.
And finally, under the headline Medid Bliss, the Mirror celebrates the husband and wife track cyclist that won medals for Paralympics GB at the Games in Paris yesterday. Neil Fakhy collected silver in the B1000 metres time trial, while his wife Laura took bronze in the B3000 metres pursuit. She celebrated with their 20-month-old son Fraser and said while there were a few tears, they were tears of joy. Unbeatable is the Eye's headline on its back page, celebrating Hannah Cockcroft's fourth straight Paralympic 100 metres title.
The time is 11 minutes past six.
Well, let's turn to those elections in Germany then. We have a first, which is that the far-right Alternative für Deutschland, the AfD, has won a state election. Looks like they're going to come second in another. Those two states represent around about 7% of Germany's population, so the implications nationally are unclear. But let's turn to our Berlin correspondent, Jess Parker, who can take us through some of that. Morning from London, Jess. Just unpick a little bit of this result for us locally. What do they mean in those regions before we turn to the national picture?
Yeah, good morning. And I'm in Erfurt, the capital of Thuringia. And look, I think important to say these are states where Alternative for Deutschland has been polling very strongly, far higher than they necessarily have nationally, where their poll rates have slipped over the course of the year from a sort of high point back in January. But they are still overall a force that is gaining traction. Here in Thuringia, looking at these results that you just outlined, yes, other parties are going to probably block the far right from being in government. They won't go into coalition with them. But there are other ways the AfD is going to be able to wield its influence, because preliminary results suggest they may get a third of the seats here in Thuringia, possibly in Saxony, which could give them blocking powers. So for things like the appointment of judges. So that could spell potential chaos at a local level. And the fact that the AfD may not be able to actually take office despite winning the most votes here in Thuringia, it could fuel their narrative that the mainstream is conspiring against them. And I think as well, it's worth pointing out in Thuringia, there's a particular sting for those who are fiercely opposed to the AfD. The party here is headed by a man called Bjorn Höcke, a talisman of the hard right of the party. There have even been efforts within the party to kick him out previously that failed. This year, he was fined twice for using a Nazi slogan, though he denied doing so knowingly. And this is a state where the party is officially deemed as right-wing extremist by domestic intelligence.
And it's worth saying as well, Jess, that in these states, Olaf Scholz and the SPD, his party, Olaf Scholz being the chancellor, took an absolute battering. He's not very popular there, is he?
Yeah, I mean, the worst-case scenario hasn't come true for Olaf Scholz's SPD, which was to actually not meet the 5% threshold and fall out of the state parliaments here altogether. The same can't quite be said here for the Greens and the Liberals, his coalition partners. But yeah, a terrible night for the traffic lights coalition in Berlin. He has given a reaction overnight, Chancellor Scholz. He said parties must form stable governments without right-wing extremists, as he put it. And he said our country must not get used to this. So this effort that you often see not to normalise Alternative for Deutschland. I think another really interesting trend is you've got another anti-establishment populist force that opposes sending weapons to Ukraine, ending Russia's sanctions, coming third in both states. And that's this brand new party, the Sara Wagen Connect Alliance. But look, certainly I think the result leaves the coalition government weaker than before. It was already pretty weak, beset by bickering and infighting. And I think it feeds a sense as well that's been building all year that German politics is becoming more polarised.
All right, Jess in Berlin. Jess Parker, good to talk to you. Thank you.
Well, speaking of Ukraine, it is a month since Ukrainian forces crossed the northeastern border and began their incursion into the Kursk region of Russia. Now, there are crucial choices about strategy and other front lines, explored in a report that will run later this morning from our correspondent Nick Beek, who has just returned to Kiev from the area that borders Kursk. What did you find, Nick?
Good morning, Michelle. Well, I should say, actually, first of all, that there were some very loud explosions here in the capital, Kyiv, this morning. This was the air defence shooting down, we're told, more than 20 Russian ballistic and cruise missiles. Falling debris injured at least two people. And all of this on the morning that Ukrainian children go back to school after the holidays. But as you say, Michelle, yeah, we spent most of the last week in the northeast of the country, including Sumy region. From there, of course, the Ukrainians launched their incursion into Russia. And we managed to get an insight, I think, into what the Ukrainian army is doing. We went right up to the border with Russia and saw that small bases had been set up in the forest there. And we spoke to some of the Ukrainian troops who'd just got back from Kursk. And they talked about how quickly they'd managed to take land a month ago and how they're preparing to return. And you did get the impression that the Ukrainians are happy to send the message that they've got no intention of giving up this Russian territory. We were also taken to a secret training location that was in the Chernihiv region, new troops being readied for the front line there. And I think the most striking thing we saw was that most of the men were in their 40s and in their 50s, which is an indication of how Ukraine really wants to get as many people as possible onto the battlefield. They're trying to compete with the huge numbers that Moscow is throwing into the fight. But I think above all, we also got a sense of this dilemma that Ukraine now faces 1 month on. Does it continue to send more troops into Russia to defend the gains of the past month? Or does it send them to the Eastern Front in Ukraine itself, where, as we know, the Russians are grinding out these very slow advances meter by meter, especially near the city of Pokrovsk. So really no simple next steps for Ukraine.
More of that in your report, which will run after 8:30. Nick, thanks very much. Nick Beek.
For now, it's 16 minutes past six. Let's turn to the business news and the conversation around Oasis entering another week because of very high prices. Sean Farrington is here with that and plenty more. Hi, Sean.
Hi, Amal. Yeah, there's sort of fewer Oasis puns around this week, aren't there, as people get a little bit more concerned about the actual process to which the prices were arrived at. Late last night, the Culture Secretary Lisa Nandy said there'll be a review looking at the transparency and the use of this term that now so many are more familiar with, dynamic pricing, including the technology around the queuing systems, which she says seem to incentivise it. I'm joined by Shelley-Ann Horn, who's the competition economist at accounting firm Grant Thornton, who's advised the authorities on these types of issues. Shelley-Ann, morning to you.
Morning.
How exactly does dynamic pricing work here, and did it work properly on Saturday?
Yeah, so dynamic pricing is really about just setting the price so that supply equals demand. So as demand for tickets goes up, and you can see the sort of untapped demand, or you can see pricing on sort of other websites, then the price goes up to try and match that supply and demand. So what we saw on Saturday was a lot of people in the queues, a lot of sort of people wanting those tickets, and perhaps there was a sort of underpricing initially in that primary market. So I think there was a realisation that actually the tickets were underpriced. There was a lot of demand. They were being resold on at higher prices. So we saw those prices going up. I think the issue was that people weren't aware of it. So we see it all the time, whether it's Uber or airline tickets or holidays or train tickets. So we're very, very used to dynamic pricing in this country. And indeed, overseas in the US, we've had dynamic pricing for concert tickets for many years. But I think this was the first time we've really seen it, I think, for concert tickets in the UK, and people just weren't expecting it.
So hang on,
I think that's where the issue came in.
Are you saying that some of those prices that people saw probably by the time they got to Saturday afternoon, where it might have been £300 or £400 for a standing ticket, that they woke up thinking that would be around £150. Yeah. That increase in price was impacted by the price on those secondary markets, the StubHub and the Viagogo, that were could have been many thousands of pounds for a ticket. Yeah.
I think it was impacted by the fact it was clear that people were willing to pay those prices. So as the prices were going up, dynamic pricing, people were paying the £300, so it increased to £325, so it increased to £350. So basically the price went up until you got to a point where it was trying to clear supply and demand. And that was partly influenced, no doubt, by sort of tickets that were sort of seen elsewhere. And the idea being that if you can price the tickets in the sort of primary market at an appropriate price, it actually reduces the sort of the amount of resale going on and the amount of profiteering that could potentially happen. So the idea is that the sort of the price goes back to either the venue or to the bands themselves, as opposed to that sort of excess profit going back to the resellers.
But do you think it's right? You're looking into the ticketing industry yourself at the moment. Do you think it's right that those prices seen on the secondary market, where people have questioned, you know, why those prices are so high, you know, being available for £6,000 within minutes of being sold in the pre-sale on Friday, that those prices should be impacting what people are queuing up for, not even knowing dynamic pricing is at play?
I'm not sure how much they are impacting. As I said, at the end of the day, it's about demand, you know, demand to supply equating. People were clearly willing to pay prices at £300-£400, and people were happy to pay those, or they wouldn't have parted with their money. So I think that was the idea, was to sort of get to a position where sort of demand, you know, equals supply. So we see that all the time on, you know, Uber. You know, we choose whether to sort of take the Uber surge or not. As plane tickets go up and down, we either buy the plane ticket, we wait to see if the tickets are going to come down nearer the time. Maybe we plan in advance, but we sort of plan accordingly, and we're used to that and we accept that. I think here it was a case that people weren't expecting to see it, and they've been in the queues for a long time expecting to see a certain price,
and as you said,
suddenly they get 3 minutes to decide whether to pay a lot more. And I think that it was the transparency, I think, that was the issue, maybe rather than the price itself.
What about
a lot of people were happy to pay those higher prices?
What about the competition issue about, you know, control over these prices here? Ticketmaster, owned by Live Nation, which is one of the promoters for the tour, as a, you know, as a competition expert, is that fair for customers, that setup? Never mind the fact that they then ended up with prices as high as they were being charged.
And I think there's two things here. There's sort of, is there a consumer protection issue? And I think, you know, potentially there is, around transparency, around fairness, et cetera. So clearly, as I said, you know, maybe people didn't realise what they, you know, the tickets were going to be so expensive. Maybe when they purchased them, they thought they were getting something else rather than that sort of regular sort of £75 ticket or whatever it was. So I think there is a sort of consumer protection issue here around transparency. If you're saying, is there a sort of competition issue per se? I think, you know, where we normally have regulation, for example, would be in water or maybe energy distribution, where, you know, there's a monopoly on supply, so there's sort of high barriers to entry, and also where you're not able to switch in the demand side. So for me and many others, you know, when I didn't get my Oasis ticket, so I sort of, you know, Peter Kay's just released a few new dates, so I sort of, you know, jumped onto the O2 website and managed to get some Peter Kay tickets. So
yeah,
you know, I was reasonably happy. So I think, I don't think we can start comparing it to sort of the competition issues we maybe see in sort of water or energy.
No, I don't think those comparisons are being made.
But I think there are sort of consumer protection issues here, maybe around transparency.
Just very briefly, Shelley-On, does it make any difference when Oasis was saying, you know, on first thing Saturday morning, those tickets won't be valid if you bought them on a secondary site?
Yeah, I think it'll be very hard to see how that's going to sort of play out in practice, as we've seen that before with sort of, you know, Taylor Swift and I think other bands trying to make those claims, and actually it hasn't been the case. And also, let's be clear that I think there's a really, that, you know, these secondary ticket markets are really, really important. Like, these, you know, concerts take many months ahead, you know, people can't always plan, but also they give you that really sort of safe, that sort of safeguarded, you know, anti-fraud sort of measures on those websites. And if you start looking at the pricing on those, you just push the tickets into the black market instead.
Well,
and you see people sort of trading them on Facebook, etc. So there is a real reason to have those as well.
We will continue that debate over the course of the programme and the days and the weeks, no doubt. Shelley-On Horne, competition economist at the accounting firm Grant Thornton. Now, moving on to the world of investment, we heard last year under the then Conservative government, lots of measures aimed to boost investment in the UK, particularly trying to persuade some of our biggest pension providers to commit more of their investments into British business. Well, today, in the world of venture capital, which is the world of investment where private investors put their money into startups and small businesses, Future Planet Capital, a venture capital firm, is today announcing a fund enabling pension managers to put more money into those startups that are potentially seen to struggle to get investment in the first place. And I've got the executive chair of Future Planet, Douglas Hanson-Luke, with me. Morning to you.
Good morning, Sean. Hi.
So, you know, if pension fund managers thought that's where I want to put the money, they'd be doing that already, wouldn't they? What difference does what you're doing today make?
Well, you'd think that, wouldn't you? But actually, over the last few years, British pensions haven't had any vehicles in which they can invest in venture capital within the regulations, and they haven't had the resources to do it either. So right. What we're aiming to do is to actually provide a vehicle which allows us to manage it professionally for them so that they can work with us, who've got over two decades of experience in venture capital, and do the same as many overseas pensions do already, you know, catching up with the rest of the world.
So it sounds like, never mind trying to just persuade pension providers to put more money into British business, as we'd heard the previous government say, that actually your industry just needs to make it more straightforward for pension providers to put more money into British business. And that's been a large part of the problem.
It's been a particular part of the issue. So British pensions have been for years investing in government debt as their primary form of investment. With the help of the previous government, and now, you know, I think it's great to see Rachel Reeves and the Treasury really taking up the baton and encouraging pensions to do the same. You know, they can do it now. We're out of Europe. There are no rules that prevent us from investing in these type of companies, high growth companies, essential for our future economy. And it's a lack of expertise, a lack of vehicles. So now we're doing it. The pension industry themselves have said that they want to put 5% into private markets. So we're the first to provide a vehicle for them to do that in venture capital.
We'll see if they do it. Can I ask you, Douglas, sorry to interrupt you, but just as you mentioned Rachel Reeves as Chancellor and people looking at Labour's policies, front page of the Financial Times this morning, headline there, squeeze on capital gains threatens to spur exodus, private equity bosses say. That's bosses from your industry. Do you agree on that, with that warning? Radical action to overhaul capital gains tax regime could spark an exodus of deal makers in the UK.
Well, let's face it, no one in any industry likes to pay more tax. But the reality is, if we can get more money into venture capital, then we'll have higher returns for pensioners, more money for British businesses, which need this to be able to compete globally. And for
are you seeing money leave the UK because of this policy?
We're not at all, no. And, you know, what I'm going to say to this and to all of my colleagues is that the more money goes into our industry, the better our chances of improved performance, the better our chances of making more money. And that's a fair return. It shouldn't be dependent on tax. If we're good, we'll make money regardless of the tax situation.
Douglas Hanson-Luke, Executive Chair of Future Planet Capital. Thank you very much. Listening to that was George Godbear, fund manager himself at Polar Capital. Morning, George.
Good morning, John.
Other headlines this morning, the front page of the Daily Mail, the Institute Director's warning that business leader confidence in the UK has been snuffed out over the summer. Bosses significantly more cautious about prospects for job creation. Are you seeing that?
Certainly a very consistent message from the management teams of the companies that we've met since that sort of rather dour speech in the Rose Garden, fears that it would be the words of the Prime Minister could snuff out the nascent recovery we're seeing. So I think there's sort of caution crept in. I think overall, you know, companies are very positive about the political stability that the UK has got at the moment, but we're probably hoping for a slightly more upbeat prospect or, you know, for growth, reflective of what the recovery they're seeing in their own markets rather than the message that the government gave.
And the former president of the Confederation of British Industry, the CBI, quoted in the Mail as well, calling on the government to concentrate on growth, but also raising this capital gains tax issue, saying any rise in it would be a short-sighted move. Are you with him or with Douglas, as we were just hearing from there?
Well, I think Doug's making some great points about, look, we've got to get pension capital into the UK. We are just lagging so far behind our economic rivals. So UK second largest pension industry, only 3% of our assets invested in the UK. Most of our economic rivals will have 40 to 50%. It's ludicrous. But I think that, you know, there's a great opportunity at the moment to sort of foster the recovery that we're seeing and the improvement, and therefore we've got to see the use of private capital for all of the important infrastructure projects we need, and we've got to create an investment environment that's good for investing in the country.
George, thank you. George Godbert, fund manager at Polar Capital. I'll be back after seven talking more about what big businesses and their bosses are thinking about the UK economy at the moment.
Sean, thank you. And let's turn to the sport now at 28 minutes past six after an extraordinary day at the Paralympics. Mike Williams has the details.
Yes, 12 gold medals for Paralympics GB yesterday. Michelle, get to that in a moment. But first, football, and we saw the biggest match of the new season in both England and Scotland yesterday, with both games ending in the same emphatic scoreline.
Another humbling for Manchester United at the hands of Liverpool. You'll never walk alone, ringing around Old Trafford. And now we see Erik ten Hag congratulate Liverpool's new manager, Arne Slot.
It was not only a win, but also a very good performance. I was really pleased about the work rate of the players. Our work rate without the ball was tremendous. And that's what you need if you play in Old Trafford.
Oh, oh, that is absolutely magnificent from the Celtic captain. Celtic 3, Rangers 0. And there's more than the length of the River Clyde between these two teams right now.
We were so exciting to watch. I just thought overall, attacking-wise, very, very impressive, but also keeping that defensive mentality to keep a clean sheet.
Yes, quite the day for Liverpool, who beat Manchester United by 3-0 at Old Trafford. And we saw the same result in Glasgow as Brendan Rodgers' Celtic won the first Old Firm derby with Rangers by 3-0. Next to Paris, and a record-breaking day for Great Britain on day four of the Paralympics. As we say, 12 gold medals in total, including for the team's highest profile athlete.
Cockcroft has three or four chair lengths. Cockcroft absolutely blitzing this field to come away and win in 16.8 seconds. A huge smile playing across the face of Hannah Cockcroft. That is four Paralympic gold medals in a row in the 100 metres.
I had a little tear in my eye when I crossed that line because I honestly didn't know if I would win it today. It means so, so much to just be able to hold on for a fourth Paralympic Games. Not many people get to do that.
Yes, congratulations to Hannah Cockcroft, who won her fourth successive T34 100 metres title last night. A dominant performance from her then, and from England's cricketers at Lord's.
Here goes Wokes. Bowls full again and hoiked in the air. The crowd know it's going to be caught. It's taken by Stone, and England complete a comfortable victory by 190 runs, their fifth consecutive victory of the summer. They're heading for a rare whitewash, an emphatic victory.
Yes, England winning the second test and the series against Sri Lanka with a day to spare. The third and final test starts at the Oval on Friday. Meanwhile, in Monza,
the chequered flag waits for Charles Leclerc, who wins the Italian Grand Prix for Ferrari, and the Tifosi explode with elation around this Monza circuit.
Not many things in Formula One more popular than a Ferrari win at the Italian Grand Prix. And that is what we saw yesterday from Charles Leclerc. Britain's Lando Norris was third in Monza. And finally, quick word on the tennis. Another big name has crashed out of the US Open.
Match point Navarro. The serve is good. The forehand from Navarro down the line. And Goff has gone wide with the forehand. Emma Navarro punches the air. She beat Goff at Wimbledon. And here she has ended her US Open title defence in the fourth round.
I mean, mentally I gave it, and emotionally I gave it my all. Obviously there's things execution-wise where I'm like, okay, I wish I could serve better. I think if I would have did that, it would have been a different story. But Emma played really well.
Yes, Coco Gauff's US Open title defence is over. 19 double faults from Gauff saw her beaten by fellow American Emma Navarro.
Mike, thank you very much indeed. Big shock there. 28 minutes to 7. Time to tell you about what's happening on Wednesday when Radio 4's head of facts and figures returns.
I'm Tim Harford, and on More or Less, we make sense of the numbers we hear in the news and in everyday life.
300 million tonnes of beef, even just in the UK.
Seems a lot, doesn't it?
We're here to answer your questions.
Is it true that the UK is growing faster than almost any other major economy?
And I've enlisted expert help to get us to the right answer.
This will surprise you as much as it did me, that actually most people don't spend quite that much every week.
These numbers do not add up.
The new series of More or Less, with me, Tim Harford, Wednesday mornings at 9 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
And the time is just after 6:30. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Amal Rajan, Michelle Hussein and Tom Sanders with the news.
Ofsted inspectors will no longer rate state schools in England with single-phrase grades such as outstanding or inadequate. The government has abolished the system, saying it wasn't fair or accurate. School inspections will continue to assess areas such as quality of education, behaviour and leadership, but the findings will be outlined in a new report card system to be developed next year. Thousands of businesses are expected to be closed in Israel today during a strike aimed at putting pressure on the government to reach a deal with Hamas to free the remaining hostages held in Gaza. Last night, hundreds of thousands took to the streets after the Israeli troops found the bodies of six hostages. The protesters are accusing the Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu of preventing a deal. He says Hamas is blocking an agreement. The German Chancellor Olaf Scholz has urged mainstream political parties not to lend support to the far-right Alternative for Germany, or AfD, after exit polls suggested it had made big gains in regional elections in two eastern states. The AfD is set to become the largest party in Thuringia and the second largest in Saxony. Mr. Scholz said the party was dividing society and ruining Germany's reputation. The trade body for the UK oil and gas sector has warned the government that its plan to increase the windfall tax on the industry would cost the economy £13 billion over the next 5 years. Offshore Energies UK says the proposed increase would lead to a significant drop in investment, which would trigger a decline in domestic production. The Treasury said it would maintain a constructive dialogue with the oil and gas sector, and the government would unlock investment and create jobs in the industries of the future. A new vaccine is being rolled out across the UK to protect babies and elderly people from one of the viruses causing coughs and colds in winter. The jab protecting from respiratory syncytial virus will be offered to pregnant women and people aged between 75 and 79. Officials say the vaccine could prevent thousands of hospital admissions during the winter.
Tom, thank you very much. Let's turn to what we now know about schools in England. Inadequate requires improvement. Good, outstanding. Parents, teachers and school staff will all be familiar with that grading system, but it is no more. Parents are going to see new grades this academic year, the Department for Education says. Anne Branwen Jeffries, our education editor, joins us now. Branwen, many people will remember the news of the suicide of head teacher Ruth Perry. What have her family said about this change, the coroner having ruled that the original system contributed to her death?
Her sister, Julia Waters, has told the BBC that the entire family are absolutely delighted. In particular, excuse me, Michelle, in particular, Ruth's two teenage daughters, because this is the one change that they had asked for. Ruth Perry took her life while she was waiting for an Ofsted inspection report to be published, which would have graded her school inadequate. And the coroner asked one key question at the end of the inquest, which said that that inspection had contributed to her death. Asking why a school like Ruth Perry's, like Caversham Primary, which was good in almost every respect, but had some failings that could be fixed swiftly, could get the same overall grade as a school that was absolutely dreadful in every respect and failing. And that's in essence what this change is about. So the overall grade goes at the top of the report that parents will often see on a banner outside a school, outstanding or good if the school has done well. Everything else that sits below that remains unchanged for this school year. So parents will still get a grade for each aspect of the school's performance, quality of education, behaviour of pupils, the leadership and management, and the same report of 3 or 4 pages describing what that means in more detail. And that is a transition until we get a report card system next year.
But those four grades across those four categories, are they numbers? Are they A to E? Or are they also using words like good or outstanding?
They are exactly as they are now. If you look at a report from Ofsted, it has the overall grade. And the overall grade matters because it drives the consequences for the school and often for the head teacher. It is that overall grade that leads the government to intervene, often to issue an academy order, which they now say they will be doing far more judiciously, instead sending in improvement teams, but retaining that legal right to change the management of a school if it is truly failing. The narrative below that, which starts with those categories and the words good, outstanding, requires improvement or inadequate, will be the same. And that's to provide some stability, because this change is coming on the first day of a new school year. It is a radical change, one that was signalled in the Labour Party manifesto, but there will be some detailed thinking that is going to need to be done to deliver a report card narrative system for September 2025.
Branwen, thanks very much.
Let's turn to politics now, 21 minutes to 7. Talk to our chief political correspondent, Henry Zeffman. Morning, Henry. Let's go through what's happening as Parliament returns. First, on the Labour side, what's on the government's horizon? And is Sir Keir Starmer, who I note from the Times is celebrating his birthday today, 62, happy birthday to the Prime Minister, is he still getting a bit of stick for a somewhat gloomy Rose Garden talk last week?
In short, yes. I mean, the Labour government is trying to bounce back into the parliamentary term with a big burst of political energy. So there's lots of big ticket legislation heading to the House of Commons this week on big Labour promises. So the renationalisation of the railways as franchises come up for renewal, that's being debated in the Commons this week. The fiscal lock designed to give more independent oversight to budgets, that's in the Commons this week. GB Energy, the creation of a publicly owned energy company, that's in the Commons this week. But hanging over all of that are questions about the budget, which will come at the end of next month. Now, Rachel Reeves has made one of what she says will be several difficult decisions already, and it's that one about the winter fuel allowance being means tested. She announced that before Parliament broke up for the summer. And over the summer, Labour MPs have received emails from anxious constituents about whether they can afford that. And that might calcify among some of them into more frustration. But look, let's remember, Keir Starmer and Rachel Reeves say there is a £22 billion black hole that they have found. Well, the means testing of the winter fuel allowance is only going to fill a very small part of that. So there clearly are more difficult tax and spend decisions coming down the track over the next couple of months.
And that's after an election in which some of the big taxes, changes to them were ruled out. What of the Tories then? Because we're finally getting some action on the Tory leadership race this week, aren't we?
A bit of action. I mean, we're still not going to know who's succeeding Rishi Sunak as leader of the Conservative Party until early November. But this week, six will become five in the leadership contest. And today, a couple of contenders are launching. So Kemi Badenoch, who's had a very quiet summer, but is absolutely one of the front runners, will launch her campaign today, saying Labour are clueless, irresponsible and dishonest. Her fellow former cabinet minister James Cleverly is also formally launching today. He'll say that he thinks that the government should eventually abolish stamp duty. Other candidates, Tom Tugendhat, Priti Patel, Robert Jenrick and Mel Stride. Now, worth noting, you know, of the front runners, I mean, Robert Jenrick only has 14 MPs who've endorsed him. Kemi Badenoch only has 11. So you might think it sounds like it's taking a while for Conservative MPs to endorse, to get off the fence. And that's undoubtedly true. But it's also a reminder that the Conservatives only have 120 odd MPs. Yes. So very small numbers of MPs will sway the future direction of the Conservative Party.
Henry, good to talk to you. Thank you.
And it will be the Education Secretary, Bridget Phillotson, who's with us on the schools change at 8:10. And we are asking for your thoughts on that change to the schools inspection regime in England. If you're affected by it, a parent or teacher perhaps, then send us a voice note on WhatsApp 0330 123 4346, or you can email us today at bbc.co.uk. But let's turn now to events in Israel, because Ben Gurion Airport, the country's main airport, is expected to be shut down this morning as a nationwide strike called by trades unions takes effect. It was called amid anger at the government as the deaths of six more hostages in Gaza was confirmed. John Donison is our correspondent in Jerusalem. Is this a significant gear change, John, from the existing pressure on the government over this?
I think it is significant, yes. The protests in Israel last night were the biggest since the start of the war. You had hundreds of thousands of people demonstrating across the country, and today this general strike. So thousands of businesses will be closed, some schools, universities, government ministries, and there are calls for more protests today from the forum representing some hostage families. They are planning to block roads across the country. Now, the outrage at Hamas is a given here in Israel, but these protests, they're not about that. This anger is directed at the government of Prime Minister Netanyahu, who is accused of blocking a ceasefire hostage release deal to prioritise his own personal political survival, something which he, of course, rejects.
What do we know about the circumstances of the deaths of the six hostages, the two women and the four men?
Well, there are two narratives, as you might expect. Israel says that they were brutally murdered by Hamas shortly before the bodies were discovered by Israeli forces in a tunnel under Rafah. So the health ministry in Israel has said that the autopsies show that they died between 48 and 72 hours before they were found. So that would have been between Thursday and Friday morning, and that they had been shot at close range. Hamas has rejected that. It says that they were killed in Israeli strikes.
John Donaldson, thanks very much.
Our main headline this morning concerns the abolition of the inspection programme in England's secondary schools. We're going to be speaking to Amanda Spielman, who is the former boss of Ofsted, at 9 minutes past seven. Let's turn now to the question of antimicrobial resistance, because there was an interesting report in the Sunday Times yesterday which suggested that a soldier who returned from Ukraine with a bacterial infection in his leg had several antibiotics attempted on him. They were of increasing strength, but they didn't work, and his leg had to be amputated. There have been warnings about antimicrobial resistance, which have grown louder in recent years. And Dr. Luke Moore is an infectious diseases consultant at Chelsea and Westminster Hospital, who was a consultant for the medical team looking after one of the Ukrainian soldiers in a hospital here in London, joins us now. Dr. Moore, good morning.
Good morning, Emil.
What is antimicrobial resistance?
So many of the listeners with us today will have had an infection at some point of their lives. Many of them will have had an antibiotic from their GP. Antimicrobial resistance is genes in the bacteria causing those infections that mean that the antibiotics we prescribe as doctors are less effective, and in some cases not effective, at killing that bacteria causing that infection.
And how big a problem is it?
So it's very heterogeneous, very variable globally and regionally here in the United Kingdom. So we see some citizens from some areas of the world that have bacteria that are resistant, and I don't like this phrase, but they're resistant to first line, second line and third line antibiotics, all the way through to some citizens who have very rarely had contact with antibiotics who have bacteria that, you know, you can kill with good old penicillin as invented by Fleming. So it's just very variable, Emil.
Why don't you like that phrase, first, second and third level? Because to a lay person such as me, that sounds like increasing strength.
All 60, 70 odd antibiotics known to modern medicine. And each one has use, each one has potential for side effects, and they are active against some bacteria here, but not other bacteria there. So rather than having tiers or lines of antibiotics, you just got to think of them as different tools. You wouldn't eat spaghetti with a knife. So they're just different things for different reasons.
It's what can actually be done about this, because the sort of common sense idea might be to radically reduce antibiotic use unless it's absolutely necessary. But does that actually work?
So I guess there's two problems here, and we've got to be really careful. I think globally, still more people are dying and having morbidity from infections because of a lack of access to antibiotics. So in some areas of the world, we really need to improve the amount and the quality and the quantity of antibiotics getting to those citizens. In our other areas of the world, what you allude to, Amal, is correct. There is an excess of antibiotics being prescribed and dispensed, and there is kind of a global north and a global south around that, if you want to use that terminology. There is no one golden bullet to answer your question about what can be done. Lots of things need to be done bundled together. There needs to be policy level decisions across the globe in terms of restriction of antibiotics. Unless there is a prescription, there needs to be an emphasis upon diagnostics to ensure that where citizens do come to healthcare professionals with infections, a diagnostic test is done to enable the right antibiotic to be given at the right strength for the right time. And then there's the change in societal perspective amongst citizens themselves around acknowledging when they've got a viral infection, antibiotics don't work. And we've got to bundle all those things and more together if we're going to slow down the increase in antimicrobial resistance that's occurring.
And finally, Dr. Moore, are we doing what we need to be doing in this country to prepare for the problems you envisage?
So we have really strong legislation here in the United Kingdom, and we have a very active approach to this from the UK Health Security Agency, which is kind of underpinned by our colleagues in primary care and secondary care looking at every single antimicrobial prescription they make. We can do more. Everyone can do more. And I think there's the upcoming UN General Assembly, which is one of the many things they're going to look at in the next 10 days or so, is going to be antimicrobial resistance. And part of that is us looking at how each other around the globe are doing. And I think we in the UK can learn from others, and others can learn from us, and sharing which interventions have helped with antimicrobial resistance, I think will help us as a globe combat this threat.
Dr. Luke Moore, good to talk to you. Thank you.
It is 11 minutes to 7. The latest BBC Panorama investigation, which is on BBC One at 8 o'clock tonight, has experimented by taking phones away from teenagers in two families for a week, and also discovered the extent to which boys are being exposed to violence and hate-related content as algorithms continually push such material to their phones. Disinformation and social media correspondent Mariana Spring has made this programme, and she joins us now. Give us a sense, Mariana, of exactly the nature of the kinds of content that boys said they see frequently.
Good morning, Michelle. And yes, there's been lots of discussion, like you mentioned earlier in the queue there, about phones and kids this summer, and particularly the impact of social media. And a lot of this does come back to the algorithms you mentioned, these recommendation systems that push us stuff based on what they think we might like and based on the preferences of other users. It's all to keep us coming back, but the kinds of stuff that can keep us gripped can also be harmful, especially for teenagers. And I've chatted to several teenagers, including Kai, who's now 18, who told me he's found it very difficult to escape violence and misogyny served up on his TikTok and Instagram feeds since he was 15. He said the tools that he's used to indicate that he doesn't want to see particular videos on the site haven't worked. And when he comments on posts to say he doesn't want them, or tries to reset his algorithms when he accidentally likes a video, his feed is just flooded with more, he says. He's into boxing, but he doesn't want to see some of this more extreme content, including glorifying domestic violence, for example. And not only has this had an impact on him, but also some of his friends too. He told me about one friend who started to adopt misogynistic views off the back of watching these kinds of videos. And Kai says his feed looks very different from those of girls the same age that he knows.
It's like you just scroll, you know, you get a video after a video. It could be a dog, and then next minute it's just someone getting run over, or a car crash, or something like that. Out of nowhere, spontaneous, it escalates very quickly. You could like it, or you could comment your opinion, be like, I don't agree with this, but you'll still get even more and more and more and more and more. Kind of just stains your brain, and it's all you think about for the rest of the day.
To find out why this was happening, I tracked down some of the people who've been working on the inside of the social media companies, including someone called Andrew Kwong, who worked at TikTok in Dublin for 19 months until 2022. And as part of an effort to help keep teenagers safer, he says he and a colleague decided to check what was being recommended to some 16-year-olds on the app.
If you're a female, a 16-year-old who live in London, they're just usually interested in the pop singers, the songs, makeup, whereas like it's very different for a teenage boy. And so stabbing, knifing type of content, sometimes sexual content, and of course mostly with the misogynistic sort of controversial hate content as well.
According to Andrew Kwong, the algorithm's fuel is engagement, regardless of whether that engagement is positive or negative. And that could explain in part why Kai's efforts to manipulate the algorithms weren't working. According to TikTok, the algorithms are not informed by a user's gender, but Andrew says the interest teenagers express when they sign up often have the effect of dividing them up along gender lines, which explains why a 16-year-old could be recommended violent content to begin with. Andrew says the algorithm recommending content to TikTok's For You page doesn't always differentiate between harmful and non-harmful content. And one of the problems he identified when he worked at TikTok was that the teams involved in training and coding that algorithm did not always know the exact natures of the video that it was recommending. Ofcom raised similar concerns to Andrew about kids when I spoke to them. Even if it's the minority being exposed to harmful content on social media, they say that this becomes unavoidable and it is being recommended to them. I reached out to the social media companies about all of this. TikTok says that it has 40,000 2,000 safety staff working alongside innovative technology to keep its app safe. It says it doesn't use gender to recommend content, has settings for teens to block content that may not be suitable, and doesn't allow extreme violence or misogyny. Meta, which owns Instagram, says it's introduced over 50 different tools, resources and features, including for parental supervision and reducing sensitive content for teens.
Mariana, thank you. Panorama, Can We Live Without Our Phones, is on BBC One and iPlayer tonight.
7 minutes to seven. Across Norfolk and Suffolk, there have been several confirmed cases of blue tongue virus, BTV3. Blue tongue doesn't infect people. It doesn't affect animal products like milk or meat either, but it is a potentially nasty problem, so much so that the chief veterinary officer has declared a blue tongue restricted zone, and she joins us now. It's Professor Christine Middlemiss. Professor Middlemiss, good morning.
Good morning, Emil.
What is blue tongue?
So blue tongue's a virus of ruminants. So for us, that's mostly cattle and sheep. It affects very small blood vessels. And so we get clinical signs that can cause death and definitely can cause big production impacts in those species. And so quite an important disease for us.
Yeah. And what are the risks to livestock and to humans?
So there's no risk to humans. This is not a virus that spreads to humans. And there's, as you said, no risk in meat or milk. It's spread in midges. So this is what makes it quite difficult to manage. Midges with virus bite an animal and create infection. And of course, midges, when it's warm, are moving around the country. That's why we think we've got virus blown in midges from the continent, where we know there's a lot of infection.
And what are the signs in animals?
So signs can be death, but things like having a swollen head, nasal discharge, lameness, crustiness around the lips and the mouth and nose, a temperature. You can have, they can abort if they're pregnant. And in an inappetence going off their feed. So quite a variety of symptoms. And our message to livestock keepers is, particularly in that area, if you have an animal with any of these clinical signs, do call the Animal Plant Health Agency and report.
And how can it be treated?
So you can treat the clinical signs symptomatically to make the animal feel better, but that doesn't get rid of the virus. The animal has to recover itself. Some do recover, but some have clinical signs that are so bad it can cause death, and that's certainly where the Netherlands, where they've had a huge amount of infection. They lost a large number of sheep last year with it and ongoing this year. And that's partly why we've put in the movement restrictions, because it's in midges and because there isn't really effective treatments. So people moving animals to a free area have to have them tested before they're moved.
Right. I know you're a distinguished scientist rather than economist, but do you think there may be an impact on milk and meat prices, dairy prices generally?
I think given where it is in the country and the type of livestock we have there, no, not for us, unless infection. You know, if it gets very warm and that continues for the autumn and the midges are very active, then the level of infection and number of animals infected is going to increase. So we're being very vigilant and working very closely with industry around that. But for the moment, it is in areas of, for us, less dense livestock production.
Professor Christine Middlemiss, Chief Veterinary Officer, thank you very much indeed for your time.
3 minutes to seven. Elizabeth Rizzini has this morning's weather. Morning, Elizabeth.
Good morning. Thanks, Michelle. Well, it was very warm yesterday. Very warm start to the meteorological autumn. 30 degrees Celsius recorded in West Sussex. Now, we're still in that muggy air mass throughout today, but we'll eventually draw in fresher feeling conditions by the time we get tomorrow. But it's a warm and a muggy start, particularly for parts of England and Wales. Temperatures in some spots 19 degrees Celsius this morning. We could possibly see some more thunderstorms today. The greatest chance of those will be across Wales, the Midlands, Northern England, central and eastern areas of Scotland. And there's some rain around this morning too, mostly across Wales and through parts of Scotland too. A lot of cloud and some misty, murky conditions, very poor visibility. Some of the coastal and hill fog likely to last throughout the day, and there will be a lot more cloud around too than yesterday. For Scotland then, showers, low cloud. The showers pretty widespread throughout today, best of any brightness towards the far south and the east. For Northern Ireland. Well, we'll see some rain through the morning. Again, plenty of low cloud, but by the afternoon, fresher feeling conditions and some sunny spells. England and Wales, a few early thunderstorms gradually tracking northwards. It's a messy picture here. There will be some showers, some cloud, patchy rain, but also some sunny spells and possibly some more afternoon showers developing too. It's still feeling warm and muggy here. Top temperatures 15 to 18 Celsius in the far north and the west, but 21 to 24 Celsius. Further south and east, parts of East Anglia could get up to 25 or 26 Celsius perhaps. Perhaps later.
Thank you, Elizabeth.
Knowledge has transformed our understanding of the universe and ourselves. But I'm here to argue that ignorance is just as important.
Every new creative endeavour basically begins in ignorance.
A new series exploring the power of ignorance from art to science to politics.
Just to have in the back of your mind that whatever I believe may in fact be wrong. Because that opens me up then to being receptive to other viewpoints.
The Long History of Ignorance from Confucius to QAnon with me, Rory Stewart, on BBC Radio 4. Available now on BBC Sounds.
In the next hour, a gold rush for Paralympics GB.
It's going to end with a gold. Gold for Great Britain. It is a fit gold in the velodrome for the British paracyclists. A 14th medal, a table-topping effort.
And there was even more of that yesterday. Two of Sunday's champions will be with us before eight.
You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4. It's 7 o'clock on Monday, the 2nd of September. The headlines this morning. Single phrase ratings by inspectors of state schools in England have been abolished. Strikes and more protests are taking place in Israel to demand a deal to free hostages held by Hamas. A new vaccine to protect babies and the elderly from a cold virus has been hailed as a game changer. The BBC News is read by Tom Sanders.
The government has scrapped one or two-word Ofsted ratings for state schools in England. It says they don't provide a fair assessment of overall performance. The decision comes 8 months after an inquest found that an inspection that judged a primary school in Berkshire as inadequate contributed to the suicide of its head teacher, Ruth Perry. The change has been criticised by the Conservatives, who say it removes a vital indicator for parents. Here's our education editor, Branwen Jeffries.
From today, no school in England will be issued with a single overall grade, such as outstanding or inadequate, following an Ofsted inspection. The inspection standards will remain the same, and the reports will still grade areas such as quality of education, behaviour and leadership. A new report card system will be developed by September 2025. The family of Ruth Perry has been calling for the change. Her sister, Julia Waters, said they were delighted because the prospect of an inadequate grade had contributed to her sister's suicide.
That word, inadequate, just... she went over and over and over it. She kept repeating it. She wrote it down. And it was that feeling, not just that she'd had the terrible shock and trauma of a completely unexpected bad Ofsted, but that she was still anticipating the public humiliation that would come with that.
MPs had also called for the one or two-word grades to be replaced after hearing that Ofsted had lost the trust of the teaching profession. Education unions welcomed the scrapping of grades they said were crude and damaging.
Israel is bracing for a general strike called by trade unions and groups representing the families of Israeli hostages in Gaza. The aim is to force the government to reach a deal to free those still held by Hamas. Yesterday saw large protests after it emerged that six more hostages had been killed before Israeli forces could save them. Our correspondent John Donison reports from Jerusalem.
After last night's protests, the biggest seen in Israel since the start of the war, with hundreds of thousands demonstrating across the country, today a general strike. Thousands of businesses will be closed, some schools, universities and government ministries. A forum representing some hostage families has called for more demonstrations across Israel today, with plans to block the country's busiest roads. The outrage at Hamas is a given, but these protests are not about that. The anger is directed at the government of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who is accused of blocking a ceasefire and hostage release deal to prioritise his own personal political survival. After the latest discovery of the bodies of six hostages, some families say he has their loved ones' blood on his hands. At last night's protests, there were chants of murderer. Mr. Netanyahu rejects this. He says it is Hamas which is blocking a deal and insists they will be pursued and brought to account.
The far-right party Alternative for Germany, or AfD, is celebrating significant success in yesterday's regional elections in two eastern states. Exit polls suggest it will be the largest party in the local parliament in Thuringia and second largest in the neighbouring Saxony. Other political parties have ruled out forming coalitions with the AfD. Our correspondent Jessica Parker reports from the capital of Thuringia, Erfurt.
This is an unprecedented victory for the far-right Alternative for Deutschland, but many Germans with an eye on the country's Nazi past view it as making history of the wrong kind. In Thuringia, the AfD is officially classified by domestic intelligence as extremist. It's a label the party rejects as it's tapped into anger about immigration and some people's misgivings around sending weapons to Ukraine. Last night, the AfD's national leader, Alice Weidel, said her party could now no longer be ignored. But the complicated process of coalition building is likely to exclude the AfD because other parties won't work with it. For Chancellor Olaf Scholz, it's another blow. His embattled, bickering coalition government emerges from these regional polls even weaker than before, a year out from the federal elections.
MPs return to Parliament from their summer recess today. Ministers are promising a busy agenda, including votes this week on legislation to nationalise the railways. Our political correspondent Nick Eardley reports.
The government is promising to get on with the job as Parliament returns, with a pledge of a packed legislative agenda. There will be votes in the Commons this week on bills to require independent oversight of big financial policies and to bring rail companies into public ownership over time. In the coming weeks, there will be further bills to strengthen workers' rights and reform the rental market. There is, however, no escaping doom-laden messages from ministers about the state of the public finances and what they describe as the need for difficult decisions. That points to some tax rises and spending squeezes in next month's budget. Some Labour MPs fear the government has been too negative in its messaging over the summer. There's also concern among Labour MPs about the decision to remove winter fuel support for millions of pensioners not on pension credit. Opposition parties will try and force a vote on the issue in the coming days.
Ministers are being warned that increasing windfall taxes on oil and gas production would cut tax revenues from the industry by as much as £12 billion by the end of the decade. The assessment has been made by the trade body Offshore Energies UK. Here's our business editor, Simon Jack.
Labour's manifesto promised to increase taxes on oil and gas profits from 75 to 78% till 2030, abolish existing tax breaks for further investment, and refuse any new exploration licences while honouring existing ones. The industry is mounting a sustained campaign to water some of those promises down. Just a week ago, 42 firms in the oil and gas supply chain signed an open letter to the Chancellor warning of job losses. Offshore Energies UK has just published research claiming that tax receipts to the Treasury will fall by £12 billion by 2030, cost 35,000 jobs, and increase the UK's reliance on foreign energy imports. The Treasury said it was committed to maintaining a constructive dialogue with the oil and gas sector and said other manifesto pledges would unlock thousands of jobs in the renewable industries of the future.
A new vaccine to protect babies and elderly people from a cold virus is now available on the NHS across the UK. It's hoped the rollout could help to ease pressure on hospitals in the winter. Officials say tackling the virus, known as RSV, could be a game changer. Here's our health correspondent, Sophie Hutchinson.
It's estimated that 20,000 babies are hospitalised in England each year with illnesses linked to RSV, and up to 30 die as a result. The virus also affects elderly people and contributes to 9,000 hospital admissions for pneumonia each year. The new vaccine will be offered to women who are at least 28 weeks pregnant and people aged 75 to 79 years in all parts of the UK from today.
Sir Ian McKellen has told the BBC that at 85, he has no plans to retire from acting as long as his legs, lungs and mind keep working. He fell off stage earlier this year during a West End production, breaking his wrist. He's been speaking to our correspondent Tim Muffett.
Sir Ian McKellen says his fall in June was a complete accident and had nothing to do with his age. The actor told the BBC his foot became caught in a chair on stage and whilst trying to kick it away, he skidded off stage. He's taken some time off but isn't considering retiring. In his new film, The Critic, McKellen plays a gay theatre critic writing in the 1930s, a character persecuted for his sexual preferences. Sir Ian came out as gay aged 48 in 1988, whilst campaigning against the Section 28 laws that banned the promotion of homosexuality in schools. He now says he regrets not coming out earlier. Asked about whether he'd return as Gandalf in the forthcoming Lord of the Rings movie, he said he'd not let anyone else put on the pointy hat and beard if he could help it.
And we'll hear an interview with Sir Ian on this programme at 8:20.
Tom, thank you very much indeed. It is 9 minutes past seven. So, a new term is starting in England this week and a new inspection regime for schools. No more single or two-word inspections, such as outstanding or inadequate, in secondary schools. The inspection standards will remain the same and the reports will still grade areas such as quality of education, behaviour and leadership. The government said the change, which follows the suicide of headteacher Ruth Perry in 2023, was needed to reduce the high stakes for schools and give parents a better picture. Well, let's speak to Amanda Spielman now, who is was Chief Inspector of Ofsted from 2017 to 2023. Amanda, good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for coming in to see us. What do you make of this decision?
Well, I think it means that the new government recognises that the previous government had simply loaded school inspection up with too heavy a burden of consequences. And it means that behind the scenes, government is changing or withdrawing many of the policies that it had hung on overall effectiveness judgments, especially academisation. I simply could not respond to many of the concerns last year because the government at the time wouldn't acknowledge that fear of inspection overwhelmingly related to the fear of consequences. I listened a lot to the sector. I knew that. So this is quite a very interesting switch and potentially a powerful switch to say all of the richness of the information that inspection provides really matters. Those judgments of individual areas really matter. I think this is beneficial for inspection. I think it's beneficial for schools. I think it's beneficial for parents and children.
I mean, the one-word or two-word system was in place for many years, so there must have been a case for it. What was that case?
People mix things up. It's not actually the wording of judgments that's changing. It is the overall effectiveness judgment that's being removed. Now, it's the consequences that were hung on that that were doing the damage. There is actually some value in an overall effectiveness judgment. Many inspectorates use them, but if it is going to carry disproportionate weight, it's better to focus people on the individual judgments like quality of education, behaviour, personal development and so on.
But what was that value? If there was a value, what was that value? Was it the clarity for parents?
Yeah, when you survey parents, generally, they like the simplicity and clarity. Various surveys have showed stronger support from parents for models with overall effectiveness judgments. But nevertheless, they had become, because of the weight of consequences that government had hung on them, they had become more of a problem than a help.
Because last July you said that it would become a problem if they, the assessments, became, as I think you're repeating now really, if they became so wrapped up in so many words that it's hard for parents and users to know what they need. And is that still a concern for you?
It would be, yes, but this announcement is not about changing the wording of judgments. It's simply about taking out that overall effectiveness judgment and the consequences linked to it. There was a big ratchet in 2021 when the academisation was linked not just to inadequate judgments, but also to a second requires improvement judgment. And that really increased fear in the sector to an unhelpful degree where people could barely concentrate on the process of inspection because they were so worried for their futures.
But isn't there then a danger that this move reduces the clarity for parents?
That's the risk. And this shouldn't be about simply putting the interests of schools and their staff ahead of children. It's really important that inspection is first and foremost for children. But I believe that you can do that, provided you have this full set of judgments. The other thing that I think is implied by this announcement is that the short, ungraded inspections that were all government would fund Ofsted to do for most schools will be scrapped so that it can do a full set of judgments in every inspection.
And to what extent do you think the government is softening the consequences of inspections?
It's clear from the announcement that that ratchet of the second requires improvement judgment leading to intervention is being taken out. I advise government strongly against putting it in the first place. It's also clear that they will rightly be keeping the power to intervene for schools with serious problems. And of course, that's a very necessary protection for children and their parents.
Do you think it's a bit weird that they've said they'll scrap these, but they haven't been very clear about what's going to replace them?
Yes, there's very little that's being taken out. It's actually only the overall effectiveness judgment that's being taken out, which means government is taking... I couldn't change that because the policies... Government had many, many policies that linked directly to those policies. So nothing could change at the Ofsted end because government didn't want to change.
And has
but the scorecard that comes out, that is the next stage, I would expect it to look like an evolution of the scorecard that inspections already give about quality of education, behaviour, personal development. It'll be an iteration of that.
And has Ofsted got the resources to do what it needs to do?
It hasn't had... been properly resourced for a very long time. Three quarters of the school inspection budget has been gradually pulled out of it over the last 20 years.
But you want Bridget Phillipson, who's on this programme in less than an hour, to provide more money?
Well, to provide a full scorecard in every inspection will mean more inspection work.
And that needs to be funded?
That will have to be funded, of course.
Amanda Spielman, very good to talk to you. Thank you.
14 minutes past seven as many children head back to school today for that new academic year. MPs head back to Westminster for their own autumn term, which will include the first budget of the new Labour government. And today means welcome back to the airwaves to our political editor, Chris Mason. Morning, Chris. How are you?
Hi, good morning. Yeah, very well, thank you.
So how do you think that, from the government's perspective, how do they want this period, this long run-up to the budget, to feel?
Well, they'll want to project a sense of sort of energy and getting on with stuff. We heard in the news a few minutes ago some of the legislative plans that are coming from this week. But the backdrop is clear and one that they have chosen to paint themselves, which is this rather grey, autumnal kind of gloom as far as what they say are the tough decisions, the tough choices, as Rachel Reeves, the Chancellor, put it over the weekend, that they've got to take. They've been feeling a little bit of heat from the charity sector, from some of their own MPs, certainly from opposition MPs, around the whole decision around winter fuel payments and that being restricted to just those on pension credit. And we know that there will be other difficult decisions, as ministers like to describe them, in other words, putting up taxes and cutting spending, to come. And it's a long old countdown until the budget, because the budget isn't until the end of next month, and we're only just into this month. So that gives you some sort of sense of the time they are giving to roll this sort of pitch of gloom, if you like.
Well, is it going to continue that way, or is there a sense that perhaps they've gone a bit too far on that?
There is a sense from some that they've gone a little far, and I think they will try and feather it, counter it a little bit in the coming weeks with a bit of a greater sense of optimism. At the same time, their overall strategy is one of doing the tough stuff first. They make this argument that their inheritance means that that is necessary. You hear a counter argument, we'll hear it this morning from some of the Conservative leadership wannabes, that is to overstate things. But there's a political logic, so say Plenty in government's doing the tough stuff now because you do it immediately after an election rather than, and I shouldn't mention the next election now, should I really, but rather than when another election is getting closer.
Yeah. Well, of course, by the time the budget comes, that new leader of the Conservative Party will have been in place for several weeks. What's your sense of that race?
Well, not quite, because the whole thing is going on for ages. It's a four-month contest and we are 2 months in. So this contest is twice as long as it took Christopher Columbus to sail to America and 2.5 times as long as Liz Truss lasted as Prime Minister, but is not atypical for a big party that's lost an election to go through a decent length campaign for a new leader. We won't actually find out who the new Conservative leader is until the beginning of November. Budget's at the end of October. So there is, in that sense, this long, long wait for a new Conservative leader. We've had snazzy social media videos, we've had splashes of geographical masochism from the candidates dashing around the country in August, and there's more of it. There's Kemi Badenoch, seen by quite a few as the front runner, giving a speech later. James Cleverly too, the former Home Secretary. Robert Jenrick was out over the weekend. Tom Tugendhat will be out tomorrow. So there is plenty to come, and that will ratchet up with the first voting on all of this happening on Wednesday, and one of the six wannabes knocked out.
Chris Mason, thank you.
Well, just going back to Ofsted for a moment, we know many of you feel very, very, very strongly about the Ofsted inspection regime, have written to us in the past, and we're very keen to hear from you. So just tell us what you think of the decision to scrap that single headline grade. Perhaps you're a teacher or a parent who's been affected. Perhaps you're a grandparent. Perhaps you're a former inspector, or indeed a current pupil who feels strongly about the new regime or the old one, whatever it may be. Please send us a message. We'll put your thoughts into the mix, and we'll consider them as we interview the Education Secretary, Bridget Phillipson, after 8 o'clock. You can email us. The address is today@bbc.co.uk, or you can contact us on WhatsApp. The number is 0330 123 4346. That's 0330 123 4346. You can either type a message, or you can send us a short voice note by putting your finger on that little microphone button next to the bar you type into.
Now, though, Sean is back with us, having looked at some details emerging about confidence among business leaders and where it stands at the moment.
Yes, Michelle, I was making a few headlines this morning that confidence dropped in August. According to the Institute of Directors, that represents bosses from around the country, they do a survey, monthly survey. Last month, after the election, that survey saw a three-year high. 1 month on, the IOD saying there's now more caution around job creation and investment plans. I've got John Mewitt with me, who's chief executive of the tools retailer Screwfix, who themselves today are raising concerns about a skills gap in the trade industry. Morning to you.
Good morning, Sean.
I wanted to ask you about that skills gap shortly, but just on these comments that are around this morning, that news in recent weeks on employment rights changes, tax rises, hitting confidence, are they actually hitting your business plans?
I think it's early days at the moment. Our customers are still telling us they're still very, very busy. 75% of our tradespeople are booked up for the next 6 months. Clearly, in that report, they talk about skills and labour shortages as one of the key factors. And I think, especially if the government wants to build 1.5 million homes, this is going to be a real problem. And we're seeing the skills gap being a real challenge. In fact, we're on course for a shortfall of 250,000 tradespeople by 2030.
Right. How big a problem? 1.5 million homes to be built. What would they be able to get to if we just continued with the number of workers we've got right now?
Well, there's not enough young people coming into the trade to fill the gap left by those retiring. And we all know how difficult it is to find a tradesperson. Also, tradespeople need tradespeople to do their jobs. If you're a plumber doing a bathroom, you need a tiler or an electrician. And they're telling us it's the biggest problem. 92% of our tradespeople are telling us that they don't think schools are doing enough to promote a career in the trade.
Is the industry doing enough to engage directly with these young people that you say you need so much?
Well, I think a trade career versus going to university is a great opportunity. We run a trade apprentice competition every year to find the best trade apprentice in the UK. And I mean, if you take our winner in 2023, Katie Jones, straight A student, she was advised the only pathway was to go to university. She didn't think it was right for her. So she got an apprenticeship in plumbing and heating. She's now a really successful plumbing and heating engineer. So I think there's lots of exciting options going into the trade, and it's a great career for young people.
I just wanted to ask you finally specifically about capital gains tax, John, just sort of flipping back to those confidence questions again. Is there an issue, do you think, with a capital gains tax increase if that's what we see come the budget?
Well, I think we need to wait and see what develops. But I mean, clearly anything that hinders the opportunity to build new homes and create investment is not going to be great.
John Mewitt, Chief Executive of the tools retailer Screwfix.
Sean, thank you. 22 minutes past seven. A new NHS vaccination programme begins in England, Wales and Northern Ireland today, offering protection against the pneumonia-like RSV virus to new categories of people. For the first time, pregnant women after 28 weeks of pregnancy and also older people aged over 75. Scotland's programme began last month. Professor Sir Stephen Powis is the Medical Director for NHS England. Morning, Professor Powis.
Good morning.
How serious can RSV be?
Well, fortunately for most people, RSV, which is a common respiratory virus, causes cold-like symptoms. It's not serious, but for unfortunately, again, for a significant number of babies and older people each year, it is a serious infection. So we know about 20,000 babies need hospital care each year because of RSV. And unfortunately, 20 to 30 die each year. So this is a very significant moment. The rollout of this vaccine will have a significant effect on those hospital admissions, on the need to go to hospital, and of course, will save lives.
That is such a striking number. 20,000 babies, you say, need hospital treatment because of RSV.
Yes, that's right. And we think this vaccine, which has shown to be effective, it reduces severe lung infection by 70% in babies in the first 6 months of life. Will prevent up to 5,000 hospitalizations and 15,000 A&E attendances for infants each year. And a further 2,500 hospital admissions for older people will be prevented as well each winter. So this is a really important vaccine. As I say, we'll be contacting people aged 75 to 79 in order to offer the vaccine. And for women who are pregnant, as you say, from 28 weeks of pregnancy, speak to your maternity service and we will be talking to you as you come to your antenatal clinics to offer that vaccine.
And is this the first winter that pregnant women have been offered the vaccine?
Yes, this is the first winter these vaccines have just become available. But RSV is a virus. It does peak during the late winter, but it is around during most of the year. It's not going to be a seasonal vaccine campaign. So you will be able to get the vaccine at any time of year.
And one can understand that that kind of protection is important not only for individuals, but also to help protect the NHS because the winter is such a difficult time. This is the time of year, isn't it, when there is usually a meeting between you at the NHS and government about upcoming winter pressures. Has that been scheduled? Are you on course to have that same gathering with the new government to prepare for the winter?
Yes, well, of course, we start to plan for winter very early on. As each winter ends, we're looking forward to the next winter. So we were doing that in the spring. And of course, we've had conversations with the new government around our winter planning for this year. We'll be building on many of the things that we know were effective last year, such as virtual wards, keeping people out of hospital, ensuring that we have the extra bed capacity that we put in place last year. And of course, ensuring that other services such as pharmacy outside of the traditional services can take the load of general practice and other parts of the health service as well. So those plans are well advanced, but winter is always tough in the NHS. The vaccine programmes are an important part of that. So as we get to winter, make sure if you're eligible, you have your flu vaccine, you have your COVID vaccine, because you can help us by keeping yourself well.
Have your winter plans been fully funded? Because normally there is an injection of extra months for exactly this reason, the winter.
Yes, so we have been looking at funding, obviously, going into this winter. We continue to talk with government around funding that might be required over the winter months. But I think the important thing to say is that we don't start planning for winter. At the end of summer, we start planning for winter well in advance. And we're always building on the good work of last year, which saw us improve on most of the key targets that we look at. We're not where we need to be, but certainly compared to the winter before, we did better last winter. And we aim to keep that up this winter, of course.
Professor Sir Stephen Powis, thank you.
26 minutes past seven and Mike's got the sport.
Thank you, Amal. Back to school across the UK and back to business for Liverpool in the Premier League. An emphatic 3-0 victory over Manchester United yesterday saw Arne Slot's side make it 3 wins from 3 at the start of the new campaign. Afterwards, though, the Liverpool forward Mo Salah, who scored at Old Trafford, revealed that this would be his last season with the club. In Glasgow, Celtic were also 3-0 winners in the first Old Firm derby of the new season against Rangers. next to Paris, and a record-equalling day for Great Britain on day four of the Paralympic Games. 12 gold medals made it GB's most successful day at a Paralympic Games this century. Amongst the big winners were Maisie Summers-Newton in the pool, who took 100 metres breaststroke gold, and for Hannah Cockcroft on the track, who won her fourth successive 100 metres title. Meanwhile, in the velodrome...
Gold for Great Britain. It is a fifth gold in the velodrome for the British paracyclists. They were dominant from start to finish. From the moment Cadina Cox left the gates, there was no doubt who was going to win the gold medal.
Yes, Cadina Cox leading the charge for Great Britain as they claimed team sprint gold in style. And delighted to say that Cadina Cox joins us live on the programme now from Paris. Morning, Cadina.
Good morning.
First of all, huge congratulations from all of us on that gold medal yesterday in what was, we have to say, an utterly dominant performance from start to finish. GB finishing nearly 2 seconds quicker than Spain, who took silver.
Yeah, no, it was a great performance. Me and the boys came together and were able to dominate, which is what we do when we're in great form. So I'm glad I was able to get out there and just do what I do without letting the boys down.
And for you personally, this is being styled as redemption, isn't it? Because we all saw the horror start that you had to these games, crashing out of the C4 500 meters time trial on the opening day last Thursday, falling at the first bend. You were very emotional after that, said that it was a nightmare and that these Paralympics had been your worst ever. And yet, just a few days later, here we are with a gold medal around your neck.
Yeah, no, it wasn't the start I wanted. And, you know, having rode a very messy first round, which was, you know, Stogel had me second ranked by a good margin, knowing I could go into the final and ride so much better, I was just disappointed I wasn't able to execute that, show that and defend my title. So to be able to, you know, come out on Sunday, just a couple of days later, and defend that title, having gone through the emotional roller coaster, I have to say I'm very proud of myself.
And is it true that you were in two minds about even competing in the team sprint last night? I read that it was your teammate Jody Cundy who had to sort of help persuade you to get on the bike and line up for the final yesterday.
Yeah, it took everyone to get me on that start line. I kind of locked myself away for the first day and a half, 2 days, and just didn't want to speak to anyone. And then with the boys, I didn't want to get on the start line and, you know, crash out again and let them down. When my MS lets me down, it's one thing, but letting other people down, it's... But also, I didn't want to, you know, not get on the start line and let them down. So I was in two very different minds, but neither of them was going to be beneficial. So I thought, you know, I can go out there and make a mistake, or I can sit here and regret it. And, you know, mistakes are easier to get over than regrets.
Well, you certainly didn't let anyone down last night. GB bringing it home in style, and congratulations to you once again. And many thanks for joining us, getting up early to speak to us on the programme today. That is Cadina Cox, gold medal winner, alongside Jody Cundy and Jaco van Gass in the team sprint last night for Paralympics GB. One of five medals in the velodrome, 14, five gold medals in the velodrome, 14 in total. More Paralympics chat to come later this hour in the programme with, I believe, another GB gold medal winner. And just to say, in the next hour, we will also reflect on that emphatic win for England's cricketers at Lord's yesterday over Sri Lanka, including an historic weekend for one Joe Root.
Thank you very much, Mike. Let's turn to something later today. The story of a child with multiple care requirements and what it reveals about health and social care.
In-depth features on BBC Radio 4.
She loves it when people chat with her.
She has a rare genetic disorder.
Meet Nora, a non-verbal seven-year-old with complex disabilities.
If you're really lucky, you'll get a beautiful smile.
Oh, Nora.
Charting her round-the-clock care.
We are getting better and better at giving complex children the support they need to, well, to stay alive and stay well. We're still not there in terms of giving them a life.
Complex, a new three-part series on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds, starts this morning at 11.
A quick look at the weather. Today will bring heavy showers for many, while the risk of thunder will persist. Some brightness is likely for eastern areas of England.
You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Tom Sanders reading the news.
The government has scrapped Ofsted's single phrase overall ratings for state schools in England. Until now, inspectors awarded one of four headline grades: outstanding, good, requires improvement, and inadequate. Ministers say that wasn't fair or accurate, and a new report card system will be developed by September next year. The former chief inspector of Ofsted, Amanda Spielman, told us the single phrase grades have become more of a problem than a help. A nationwide strike affecting business, schools and transport is underway in Israel, aimed at putting pressure on the government to reach a deal with Hamas to free the remaining hostages held in Gaza. Last night, hundreds of thousands took to the streets after the Israeli troops found the bodies of six hostages. The protesters are accusing the Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, of preventing a deal. He says Hamas is blocking an agreement. The German Chancellor Olaf Scholz has described as worrying the gains made by the far-right Alternative for Germany, or AfD, in regional elections in two eastern states yesterday. The AfD is set to become the largest party in Thuringia and the second largest in Saxony. Other political parties have ruled out forming coalitions with the AfD. The trade body for the UK oil and gas sector has warned the government that its plans to increase the windfall tax on the industry would cost the economy £13 billion over the next 5 years. Offshore Energies UK says the proposed increase would lead to a significant drop in investment, which would trigger a decline in domestic production. The Treasury said it would maintain a constructive dialogue with the oil and gas sector, and the government would unlock investment and create jobs in the industries of the future. The government says it will look at the dynamic ticket pricing model after some fans ended up paying over the odds for Oasis tickets on Saturday. High demand meant some prices more than doubled as people queued online. The NHS has started vaccinating pregnant women and older people against a respiratory virus known as RSV that can make some people seriously ill. Officials say the new jab could prevent thousands of hospital admissions during the winter.
Tom, thank you very much. The time is coming up to 25 to 8. Bring them home! Bring them home! Bring them home! Israelis turned out of their thousands yesterday in the wake of news that six hostages, names and faces the entire country knew for the past 11 months, had been found dead in Gaza. They want the others still held, brought back, and for no one else to die or be killed just as a ceasefire is being negotiated. This morning, a nationwide strike called by Israel's unions is beginning with the airport. Ben Gurion Airport among the sites expected to be shut down. Sharon Lifshitz joins us once again. Her parents were both abducted by Hamas last October from the kibbutz in which they lived in southern Israel. Her mother was released in November ceasefire. Her father, Oded, who is 84 years old, is still held. Sharon, thank you for talking to us again. Tell me first about the effect on you when this news of the six hostages came through.
It's actually really devastating. We started hearing rumors in the evening, and I, you know, the first thing you think is the people you know are closer to you. And it's just impossible, because this is what we've been frightened of all this time. We know that the six people that we buried a week or two ago, they were all killed somewhere in January or February. And these one were killed 3 days ago or 4 days ago. They were young, they were strong, they survived 11 months almost, and then they were shot to the head by a Hamas terrorist.
Do you still have hope for your own father?
I have faith that we have to carry on and do everything we can. I know my work is not in vain, even if my father doesn't come and others will come. That is a work that is worth doing. And, you know, being part of a community and being the daughter of parents who always thought of the community means that you don't have only a narrow vision of the situation. You also want something that is, you know, the children of my friends that are there, the brothers of my friends that are there, we want them all back. Do I have a fate for my father? I hope if he's alive, he's well enough to survive it. It's a torture beyond all torture, and I cannot wish it for my father.
What do you want your government to do now?
Not to destroy the last hope we have of returning these hostages. We know the situation is deteriorating. We have asked the citizens of Israel for months to join us on the streets. They have now joined us on the streets. This is an incredible development. I want the government of Israel to look beyond the narrow interest of their own political parties and their own survival and do the decent things and find a way to bring these people home, to finish, to reach a ceasefire. We know that we have no time. We did not need this lesson to be saying it again and again, that we need no, there is no more time. But at the moment, because of the dreadfulness of this situation, you know, we are being interviewed again. And so our voice is heard loud and clear. But we say the same thing. Reach an agreement. Get our people back home. Stop this ongoing senseless war. And let's work towards long-term way of moving forward so that the people of this region can look forward to a future.
Does that mean that you don't believe what the Prime Minister is saying? We heard it again from Mr. Netanyahu yesterday. He says Hamas is rejecting the terms. Do you believe that the truth is different?
I believe that we have a very intelligent enemy that is evil beyond evil. I know what happened on the 7th of October. I know how much Hamas has dirtied their own hands for all eternity with the brutal, brutal, brutal actions of that day. I have no hope for them, you know. I believe that my government knows that and therefore need to act in a way that gets a deal done, gets a deal through the door. And so far, our own prime minister have done a lot to sabotage the deals at various ways. But, you know, it's not my prime minister that directly shot these hostages in the head, but saying that Philadelphia route is more important than the hostages is basically saying that their price has gone down. Until now, we were told the hostages are like diamonds and they're being looked after. We now see that they are not. And I think that at this point, we must do what it takes to bring them back home. Otherwise, we won't have many of them left.
That Philadelphia corridor, it's like a buffer zone, isn't it? A security zone in the south of Gaza that Israel has wanted. And the government would say that is part of keeping Israel more secure in the future against Hamas.
You know, at this point, we have hostages in Gaza. So I think that we can retake it if that is necessary. The Israel government did not choose to occupy it for many months before it did. It's I can see the logic for that, but I also being told that by all the top military people in Israel that we don't have to have it now, we can let it go. So the prime minister is not listening to his own chief of staff, is not listening to his own defense secretary, and I am listening to them. So they are telling me that it's possible and that what we should do now is return the hostages.
Sharon Lifshitz, thank you very much for talking to us.
Time now is 19 minutes from 8. As we've been hearing from Mike Williams, it was a truly sensational Sunday for Britain at the Paralympics. Para GB won 12 gold medals. It was the most successful day that Great Britain has had in the Paralympics this century, testament to the extraordinary efforts of so many sporting heroes who are now the pride of their families and their nation.
Sabrina Fortune. who struggled to deal with the heat and humidity in Tokyo. She's a golden shot putter here in the Stade de France.
It's going to be goal for Ellard. Darby, Maskell and Newman Baronius, the Paralympic champions again, Great Britain.
It's going to be gold for Great Britain. Goal for Sophie Unwin. 3:19, 1:49 is the time.
It's Maisie Summers-Newton who's going to come to the wall, and she's going to set a new Paralympic record as well. Liu takes silver for China.
Where is this gold medal going to go?
Ishalova into the wall. It might be Whiston. Ishalova and Whiston. And it does go to Brock Whiston.
Gold for Great Britain. It is a fifth gold in the velodrome for the British paracyclist.
It is going to be all about GB.
GB again, Britannia ruling the waves once more in the PR3 mixed Cox 4.
Ben Pritchard, a sensational gold medal for him. His first gold at the Paralympics for Great Britain.
It's going to be gold for Grace Harvey. Great Britain have claimed another gold in the pool.
It is Wells and Stevenson for a glory gold medal performance, taking down the Chinese for another gold medal in this boat division.
Well, towards the end there, you heard Lauren Rowles, who became, or you heard of, the achievements of Lauren Rowles, who became the first woman to win a rowing gold at three consecutive Paralympic Games yesterday. And she joins us on the line now from Paris. Lauren, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Oh, you tell me. Congratulations. What an extraordinary achievement. How are you feeling?
Oh, I just feel unreal. It's like I'm waking up in a dream, to be honest with you. You know, we spoke about this moment for so long and, you know, going out there and achieving it, what a moment for the team. Every medal, you know, every boat class we entered, we got a medal in every single one. And just to be part of that team was sensational last night.
Well, you're being so humble, but what about you? Because, I mean, you've done this before, you've done it twice before. I mean, it's scarcely believable to do it for a third time. How does this one compare to the other ones? A bit sweeter to have got there a third time?
Oh, most definitely. You know, when you go out and you make history, you know, I'm the first ever athlete to ever do it. And to have my name in those history books as the greatest of all time. I've been dreaming about this moment for a very long period of time. When I first started rowing and I got on the water and I looked around me at the likes of Catherine Granger and Helen Glover that were sat on the water rowing. And I wondered if I could be in a league with them one day. And yesterday, I think I entered that league with them.
Well, perhaps you're in a league all of your own. As you say, you are officially the greatest of all time in what you do. I have to say, though, Lauren, I was just watching the replays as well. You did make it rather stressful for everyone cheering you on because you left it very late. I mean, it's a 2,000 metre race, and with 100 metres to go, you're behind the Chinese boat. But it must have been utterly exhilarating to catch them and then overtake them.
Oh, definitely. You know, obviously you want to be out and leading out the front, but that's Paralympic sport as well. You know, it's year on year, it gets more and more competitive, and we just love to give the fans a good show to watch. And yeah, in that last 250 meters, I knew we had obviously ground to make up, and I said to my rowing partner Greg, who sort of sets our rhythm and our sort of rate of stroke, and I sort of said to him, right, big 250 now, and this is gonna be the last big push. And yeah, I sort of knew that when we started surging and that we sort of got that boat up to speed, I just thought, here we go. And about three strokes before the line, I thought, we've done it.
And you had. Well, for people who sort of know a bit more about maybe what happens with Olympic athletes and the training they do, how much training goes into being a 3-time gold medal winner in what you do?
Oh, it's about 30 hours of training a week. So it's, I mean, I don't think I've had a day off now for the last 5 weeks. and yeah, we train around the clock. So we train at our national training centre in Reading back in the UK. We train with our Olympic counterparts. So, you know, we are together more with each other more than our own families, actually. And we've spent, you know, every day for the last 5 weeks with each other on a training camp going into this. So, you know, being away from our families is a huge sacrifice. And, but, you know, to put it into that moment is incredible.
You were gracious enough to mention the team. I've got to ask you finally, why is Britain so strong in the Paralympics?
Oh, you know, we are just the most best prepared team. You know, the contributions of everybody, you know, from our staff to the people that support us, the National Lottery that fund us, allow us to do this as our jobs. I mean, in my dream when I was about 10 years old, I wrote in my diary that I wanted to be a runner at the Olympics and for this one day to be my job. And, you know, through support of people that play the National Lottery, we get to be able to do this, and I get to be able to call this my job and going backwards quickly for a living. And it's just an absolute dream, you know, to be able to do it and to be able to set records like this. You know, it's not many days in the office that get better than that.
Yeah, Tell us about it. Well, you're an inspiration. Absolute privilege to speak to you, Lauren. Congratulations from all of us. And we'll be cheering on Para GB for the rest of the games. Thank you.
Just after 7:45, time for Thought for the Day. And our speaker this morning is the academic and broadcaster Mona Siddiqui.
Good morning. It's been back to school in various parts of the UK. And this week, schools start in England. Even with a weekend of warm, sunny weather, the start of the school term means a new season, as summer slowly melts into autumn. But every year around this time, I remember my own school years, and when I think back, I think mostly of my friends. Returning to school is exciting, but it can also be very stressful for children. And sometimes this anxiety has little to do with studies or exams, but is more about the social aspect of school, whether a child has good friends and is happy. In all the focus on raising education standards, I think we overlook how important emotional well-being is to academic attainment. From school to adult life, I've realised how complex but important friendships are in making you feel you belong and that you're valued. I'm lucky to live in a liberal society where friendship between people of different faiths and cultures is rightly encouraged. The Quran speaks of making alliances with other believers, but while social alliances may have been important for a fledgling Muslim community, I feel my own faith in God has been strengthened by some of the soul-searching I've done over friends. Friends who've unsettled me, challenged my faith, and opened new ways of thinking about life. The writer Anaïs Nin wrote, "Each friend represents a world in us, a world possibly not born until they arrive, and it's only by this meeting that a new world is born." I regret not keeping in touch with so many of my school and university friends, and because of this, I tell my own children when they were growing up, cherish your close friends, spend time on them and with them, be open to new possibilities, but don't think you'll go through life making really good new friends. Like with everything else in life, time runs out. Pluralist societies like ours rely on reaching across divides because friendships have a powerful civic worth. When it comes to school, we know how important friendships are in helping young people develop emotionally and morally. I think of the Islamic concept of our children not just as a blessing and a joy, but a trust from God. To honour that trust, let's focus more on children's happiness as well as their learning. That children, like adults, flourish more when they cooperate rather than when they compete.
Professor Mona Siddiqui with Thought for the Day at 7:50.
For the first time, the German anti-immigration far-right party Alternative für Deutschland, or AfD, has won a state election. They've won a big victory in the eastern state of Thuringia and look likely to come second in another state election in Saxony. These two states only represent around 7% of Germany's population, so the national implications of these results will be indirect, particularly given Germany's ever more complex coalition politics. Chancellor Olaf Scholz is not very popular in these states. His SPD came a distant third. Most of Germany's main parties have said they will not work with the AfD. In Europe, even Marine Le Pen's National Rally have said they will not work with them. Varieties of national populism are in the ascendant across much of Europe. And let's speak to the AfD now, because its deputy leader, Beatrix von Storck, joins us from Germany. Frau von Storck, good morning.
Good morning, sir. I have to correct you. The Chancellor's party didn't come in third. They came in fifth in Thuringia and fourth in Saxonia.
Apologies. Anyway. Yes, they're polling third in many national results. Sorry. Thank you for correcting me. I appreciate it. Let's start with some policy, if we can, Frau von Storck. What's the main policy offer that you've made to the people of Thuringia?
That's a very easy question. I just answered it. The open border policy has been the number one in all polls. That was the main issue for the people to vote in favor of AfD. And this election has been the declaration of a failed experiment, which was started by Angela Merkel. And people are no longer supporting it by a vast majority. And this is why AfD is winning the elections, because we are the only ones. People really believe that we want to change this policy.
So what will you do differently?
We would protect our borders. We would how we do it the way we always do it when there is a World Summit, for example, and we control our borders and we make sure that only those come in who have the right to come in, who have a visa or something else. And so that's very easy. It is always functioning for some weeks when the government wants to have it functioning. So it is possible to protect your own borders. And this is all, this is what even the head of the CDU and the probably or likely next chancellor of Germany, Friedrich Merz, has said. He has said, we have to take control back of our German borders, and even by the European law, this is possible. And this is what the AfD has always said, and we were always asking for this. And this is what people want to make sure very clear, that the policy of Angela Merkel has failed dramatically, and that this has led also to a new party system. Now we can see that the party system, as it has been in the past, is gone, because now the majority in Thuringia and Saxonia relies on a very new party from the far left, which is the former Communist Party of the GDR, which is led by Sarah Wagenknecht. And Sarah Wagenknecht has made very clear she will support the CDU if ever they will change their policy towards Ukraine and the war with Russia. Okay. She does not want to deliver weapons and so forth. So the CDU has to make a shift in policy if they want to have a coalition majority against the AfD, or they have to talk to
us. I'm very glad we were able to start with the policy, because I know you've made specific policy offers, and the people of Thuringia have voted accordingly. Let's talk about some of the broader principles behind your party. Germany's domestic intelligence services described you as a suspected extremist case in parts of Germany since 2021, and that was a position upheld by a court in Münster. Why would they do that, do you think?
You know, the fact that we have a domestic intelligence service going against us is nothing what has any other Western democracy in their constitutions. This is not an independent domestic intelligence service. This is the interior minister, run by our political opponents, be it in the state of Saxonia or Thuringia, or even in the Federal Republic. So it's not an independent office which is coming to some clue. It's a politically motivated attack.
Okay. Officially. So what then is the motivation, and I wonder if you're pleased or disappointed by this, behind the fact that Marine Le Pen's national rally said that they won't sit with your party in Europe? And just so our listeners know the context, which is very important here, that was after a member of your federal steering committee, who's now no longer in that position, said he would never say that anyone who wore an SS uniform was automatically a criminal. And that was a reference to the novelist Gunter Grass. But Marine Le Pen's national rally say they won't sit with you in Europe. I wonder if you think that's also politically motivated in some bad way.
Well, you know, there was one making a very, very silly, stupid remark, and the consequences, we excluded him from our group. But, you know, we can focus on this for a longer while. People in Germany, people in the States who've just had the elections, they just do not care about this. You know, some made some stupid comment, put a stupid Facebook post. People are no longer interested. They want to make our border control back to German hands. This is what they're interested in. And you can come up with another story, small story here, and another small story against Björn Höcke in Thuringia. That's very easy. That's very fair. We can do that. But people do not longer support it. We came in second in Thuringia and first in Thuringia by almost 10% ahead of
CDU. it was a very clear victory, and there's no doubt that you've responded to public concern.
People do not buy this any longer.
Well, some people in Germany's Jewish community do care about this a lot, and they do want people to talk about your record. So, for instance, Charlotte Knobloch, who's president of the Israelite religious community of Munich and Upper Bavaria, said, and I quote, "Germany is in danger of becoming a different country again, more unstable, colder and poorer, less safe, less worth living in." So there are lots of people, including some people in minorities in Germany, including the Jewish minority, who fear you.
She's not speaking on behalf of all the Jews in Germany. She's speaking on behalf of some, and some others speaking on their behalf. And the Jews within our party, they do not support this line. And if you talk, and we know the polls within the Jewish community, that the majority there is also in favor of closing down our borders, supporting our policy line in that case, because they know what the danger, where the danger is coming from, and they're not afraid of Björn Höcke and other members of our party. So this is a very, you can go on with this, but you're losing the point. And the point is that all these, you know, debates, all these campaigns, all this mass demonstration, all these lies, all this fake news, which has been talked about a lot in German media, does not affect the electorate any longer. They know that they've got real problems and they want to have this addressed by policy.
And the point is that you've won, which is why we've, in those states, which is why we've invited you on, and hope we can speak to you again in future as well. Beatrix von Storck, Deputy Leader of the AfD in the Bundestag, thank you very, very much indeed for joining us. Let's turn to Matthew Karnischnig, who's the Chief Europe Correspondent for Politico based in Berlin and joins us now. Matthew, good morning. Just tell us a bit, if you would, we've understood a bit about the AfD, just tell us a bit about what this reveals about the state of Germany today.
Well, good morning. I think it tells us that Germans are very nervous at the moment about the influx of migrants that they've experienced over the past decade. There have been some very high-profile murders recently in Germany, with asylum seekers being accused of the killings. So, you know, this has led to a lot of unease. And it's worth remembering that Germany is taken in more migrants than almost any other country in the European Union over the last decade. And the AfD uses this issue. It is their fuel, just as it is for the Reform Party in your country or the National Rally.
Which is why national populists are surging all across Europe. Forgive us, Matthew, we have to end it there, but I hope we can get you on again to talk about this in some greater detail. And indeed, we'll return to it as a subject at 10 to 9.
The weather now with Elizabeth.
Thanks, Michelle. Well, it was very warm yesterday, of course, for some of us. 30 degrees Celsius. We're staying in that muggy, humid air mass throughout today. Fresher feeling conditions eventually tomorrow. So it's feeling muggy again today. The risk of some thunderstorms, mostly for Wales, the Midlands, Northern England, central and eastern areas of Scotland. There's poor visibility with plenty of low cloud around. We'll keep some of the coastal and hill fog throughout the day. Quite widespread showers across Scotland at the moment. The best of any brightness in the south and the east a bit later on. Watch out for those thunderstorms. For Northern Ireland, some rain too through the morning, with plenty of low cloud but fresher feeling air, some sunny spells developing a bit later on. England and Wales, again, a lot of low cloud. There'll be some patches of rain around. Any thunderstorms tracking northwards through the morning, but again, the risk of some heavy thundery showers developing this afternoon. Also some sunny spells. Temperatures for most at 15 to 24 degrees Celsius.
Elizabeth, thank you very much indeed. Coming up in the next hour, well, we're supposed to be speaking to Ian McKellen, but we've just got a message through saying he's stuck in traffic, so that could be quite interesting. At some point in the next hour, hopefully, we'll have him.
You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4. It's 8 o'clock on Monday, the 2nd of September. The headlines this morning: simple overall verdicts by Ofsted on the performance of state schools in England have been scrapped by the government. Businesses, schools and government ministries in Israel will be closed by a strike called in protest at the lack of a deal to free hostages in Gaza. And political parties in Germany have been urged not to help the far-right AfD form regional governments after its election success in two eastern states. The BBC News is read by Tom Sanders.
The government has scrapped one or two-word Ofsted ratings for state schools in England. It says they don't provide a fair assessment of overall performance. The decision comes 8 months after an inquest found that an inspection that judged a primary school in Berkshire as inadequate contributed to the suicide of its head teacher, Ruth Perry. The change has been criticised by the Conservatives, who say it removes a vital indicator for parents. Here's our education editor, Bramwyn Jeffries.
From today, no school in England will be issued with a single overall grade, such as outstanding or inadequate, following an Ofsted inspection. The inspection standards will remain the same, and the reports will still grade areas such as quality of education, behaviour and leadership. A new report card system will be developed by September 2025. The family of Ruth Perry has been calling for the change. Her sister, Julia Waters, said they were delighted because the prospect of an inadequate grade had contributed to her sister's suicide.
That word, inadequate, just... she went over and over and over it. She kept repeating it. She wrote it down. And it was that feeling, not just that she'd had the terrible shock and trauma of a completely unexpected bad Ofsted, but that she was still anticipating the public humiliation that would come with that.
MPs had also called for the one or two-word grades to be replaced after hearing that Ofsted had lost the trust of the teaching profession. Education unions welcomed the scrapping of grades they said were crude and damaging.
Ofsted's former chief inspector Amanda Spielman told us that the switch away from the overall judgments was beneficial, despite the fact many parents found them useful.
When you survey parents, generally, they like the simplicity and clarity. Various surveys have showed stronger support from parents for models with overall effectiveness judgments. But nevertheless, they had become, because of the weight of consequences that government had hung on them, they had become more of a problem than a help.
A general strike is taking place in Israel. It's been called by trade unions and groups representing the families of Israeli hostages in Gaza. The aim is to force the government to reach a deal to free those still held by Hamas. Yesterday saw large protests after it emerged that six more hostages had been killed before Israeli forces could save them. Our correspondent John Donison reports from Jerusalem.
After last night's protests, the biggest seen in Israel since the start of the war, with hundreds of thousands demonstrating across the country, today a general strike. Thousands of businesses will be closed, some schools, universities and government ministries. A forum representing some hostage families has called for more demonstrations across Israel today, with plans to block the country's busiest roads. The outrage at Hamas is a given, but these protests are not about that. The anger is directed at the government of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who is accused of blocking a ceasefire and hostage release deal to prioritise his own personal political survival. After the latest discovery of the bodies of six hostages, some families say he has their loved ones' blood on his hands. At last night's protests, there were chants of murderer. Mr. Netanyahu rejects this. He says it is Hamas which is blocking a deal and insists they will be pursued and brought to account.
The parents of Sharon Lifshitz were abducted by Hamas last October. Her mother was released in November's ceasefire, but her 84-year-old father is still being held. She told us it was encouraging to see more people demanding that the government reach a deal to free the hostages.
We know the situation is deteriorating. We have asked the citizens of Israel for months to join us on the streets. They have now joined us on the streets. This is an incredible development. I want the government of Israel to look beyond the narrow interest of their own political parties and their own survival and do the decent things and find a way to bring these people home.
Officials in Kyiv say Ukraine's air defences have destroyed a number of Russian cruise and ballistic missiles aimed at targets in the city. A water treatment plant and the entrance into a metro station were hit. Poland said it had deployed military jets to secure its airspace during the Russian strikes. The far-right party Alternative for Germany, or AfD, is celebrating significant successes in yesterday's regional elections in two eastern German states. Exit polls suggest it will be the largest party in the local parliament in Thuringia and second largest in neighbouring Saxony. Our correspondent Jessica Parker reports from the capital of Thuringia, Erfurt.
This is an unprecedented victory for the far-right Alternative for Deutschland, but many Germans with an eye on the country's Nazi past view it as making history of the wrong kind. In Thuringia, the AfD is officially classified by domestic intelligence as extremist. It's a label the party rejects as it's tapped into anger about immigration and some people's misgivings around sending weapons to Ukraine. Last night, the AfD's national leader, Alice Weidel, said her party could now no longer be ignored. But the complicated process of coalition building is likely to exclude the AfD because other parties won't work with it. For Chancellor Olaf Scholz, it's another blow. His embattled, bickering coalition government emerges from these regional polls even weaker than before, a year out from the federal elections.
A government review of ticket reselling is to examine dynamic pricing in response to anger at the use of the practice for the Oasis reunion tour. Under the system, prices online rise in response to demand. At the weekend, this resulted in some Oasis tickets with a face value of £135 being sold for £350. Last night, the Culture Secretary Lisa Nandy said it was depressing to see vastly inflated prices excluding ordinary fans. A new vaccine to protect babies and elderly people from a cold virus is now available on the NHS across the UK. It's hoped the rollout could help to ease pressure on hospitals in the winter. The Medical Director for NHS England, Professor Stephen Powis, said the new vaccine is a useful weapon against a virus known as RSV.
For a significant number of babies and older people each year, it is a serious infection. So we know about 20,000 babies need hospital care each year because of RSV, and unfortunately 20 to 30 die each year. So this is a very significant moment. The rollout of this vaccine will have a significant effect on those hospital admissions, on the need to go to hospital, and of course will save lives.
A BBC investigation has uncovered a global network charging foreign students tens of thousands of pounds for worthless visa documents they hoped would enable them to work in the UK. Some of the young people have been left penniless and without jobs. Here's our investigations reporter, Amy Johnston.
Three women from India, all in their 20s and now living in Birmingham and Wolverhampton, paid agents a total of £38,000, believing they could switch their study visas to work visas. All three received invalid paperwork that was rejected by the Home Office. The BBC has evidence that one man operating in the West Midlands, called Timur Raza, sold 141 visa application documents, most of which were worthless, for a total of £1.2 million. He denies any wrongdoing and has paid some of the money back. Officials at a Sikh temple in Smethwick, the Gurdwara Baba Sangh Ji, say that hundreds of victims of similar schemes, unsure of their visa status and scared to go to the police, are coming to them for food, shelter and support. The Home Office say tough action will be taken against unscrupulous companies and agents seeking to abuse, exploit or defraud overseas workers.
Surveys show how much the wreck of the Titanic is deteriorating after more than 100 years on the seabed. Over the past 2 months, two remotely operated vehicles have captured more than 2 million images and 24 hours of footage of both the ship, which split apart as it sank in 1912, and the debris surrounding it. A long section of the railing on Titanic's prow has broken off. Discoveries have also been made, among them a 2-foot-high bronze statue called Diana of Versailles. One of the researchers involved, James Pinker, said it would have been in the first-class lounge.
The centerpiece of that room was this bronze statue. Unfortunately for Diana, when Titanic split in two, the lounge got ripped open, and in the chaos and the destruction, Diana got ripped off her mantle. And she landed in the darkness by herself in the debris field, and the odds of finding it are just truly unbelievable.
Visits to National Trust properties rose by 5% in the last financial year to 25.3 million. But in its annual report, the Trust said overall membership had dropped by 89,000, with more people choosing to pay on the day.
Tom, thank you very much. The time is now 8:10. Ruth Perry was a respected and admired head teacher of a primary school whose life was derailed when the school she loved and nurtured was found to be inadequate by inspectors. The notes she left detail how she feared that finding, which took the school from the highest standard, outstanding, to the lowest. She worried not only about how it would affect staff and the community served by the school, but the entire area. Later, a coroner ruled that the Ofsted report had contributed to her suicide. Today, that one or two word system has been scrapped by the government. It was a manifesto pledge by Labour and one welcomed by teaching unions. And Bridget Phillipson, the Education Secretary, is in our Westminster studio now. Good morning.
Hello, good morning.
There is a recent survey, indeed it's being published by Ofsted, which shows that 4 in 10 parents liked what is now the old system, the single word judgments. Can I read to you, first of all, one email that we've had this morning from a parent who's called Anne, who said, "I found the simplicity of the one word rating ratings very helpful. It didn't overly sway my judgment, as the content of the report itself was always quite clear as to how the judgment was arrived at. My fear is that this simple system will be removed, and then the parameters of the rest of the report will be changed such that it becomes confusing to parents. How would you convince Anne that the new system is going to be better?
So as a parent myself, I want to get a really clear sense of what schools are doing well, but also where there are areas for improvement, with a sharper focus on those areas where we need to see the greatest change. So this is about shining a light on those areas, about, and as well about recognising what schools are doing well. I don't think we can capture the entire essence of a school in one word. I don't think that is the right approach. And there is broad consensus for this change, for the need to reform Ofsted and how we use this as a focus for driving up standards within our schools.
Did you not find the old system useful, though, as an indicator, as a guide into a full report?
I think parents are capable of understanding a wide range of information, not just everything being boiled down into one word. And the report card system that we intend to work with Ofsted to introduce will capture a wider range of data and information that I think parents do want to hear about. So, for example, lots of parents tell me they want to get a clearer sense about the support that's in place for children with special educational needs and disabilities. That's an area I think a new system can better capture, so that parents have got a better range of information. But alongside that, we move away from a system that is both low information for parents, but also high stakes for staff too.
Yeah, but that's a year away, isn't it, that new system? So what you're talking about now is, one person who's on a senior team in a school in London wrote to us to say, how will the government ensure that a one-word high-stakes judgment is not simply replaced with a judgment of four high-stakes words per school? Now, I'm going to explain why she's saying this. It's because those same words, inadequate, requires improvement, good and outstanding, are still going to be used, aren't they, on the four categories under which an inspection takes place.
So in moving away this year from the one word, the four subcategories that sit beneath it will remain. And as Secretary of State, I won't hesitate to take action where schools are failing. That is an important responsibility. Our children deserve a brilliant education, and we need to make sure that's being delivered. But in developing the new report cards that will follow, that will take effect from September 2025, we do want to make sure that we get that right. And that's why with Ofsted, there'll be a process of wide engagement and consultation with parents, with teachers, with school leaders, in order to design a system that better reflects a school's strengths,
but
also identifies areas for development.
We're talking about this academic year, aren't we? So how, if it's reductive to have an overall single word judgment, then why isn't the same on each of these individual categories?
Because that captures, for example, the quality of education. There are four different subcategories that sit beneath it. To boil it then down into one word, I don't think properly reflects what is working well and also what needs to change. So alongside the changes that we are making where it comes to these one-word judgments within schools, we also intend to put in place much more support for schools that are not making the progress that we would expect to see. The previous government took their eye off the ball on this. I want to make sure that we drive up standards, that we make sure schools are getting the support that they need to make improvement. And I won't hesitate to take action if schools are not making that improvement, because our children only get one chance when they're at school, one chance, okay. And we have to get that right.
Well, let's talk about that, because as things stand, it was quite clear, wasn't it? Indeed, it was in law that schools which have received an inadequate rating from Ofsted became academies, and schools which have received two or more consecutive ratings below good might also be converted into academies. So in this academic year, what is the trigger?
So it will be the inadequate subcategory, and I will retain the power to take action, to make structural change, or to put in place support for schools that are failing. Absolutely, that is
inadequate in any one of the four categories?
Yes.
Leads to becoming an academy?
It can do, or it could involve support being put in place. It will depend
on
the... Well, I retain the power to issue an order to convert that school into an academy. That remains the case in law, and that is an important part of the system, because we do need to make sure that where schools are failing, action is taken to drive up standards.
But there are lots of saying, no, but there are lots of schools. Discretionary than the old system.
No, it is not. I retain in law the power to act, to insist that a school becomes an academy. But the point that I would make is that we have lots of schools within our system where progress is slow, where in some cases those schools are already academies and they are not delivering the quality of education that parents expect. That's why I will also make sure that we put in place additional support through regional improvement teams to focus on those schools that are not delivering the education that we need to see for our children.
Where does the money for that come from?
We will make sure that through ending the tax breaks that private schools enjoy, we will invest within our state schools. And that also applies to making sure we've got the right support.
That was going to teachers.
Well, it raises quite a lot of money. So it goes to a number of different areas. It raises, as you will have seen, the Institute for Fiscal Studies have identified £1.3 to £1.5 billion net.
So you're confident then that the changes that are coming in on VAT on private schools cover everything that you want to do on teachers and on inspections?
I am confident that we will have the resources that we need to make the change that parents want to see and to honour the commitments that we have made within our manifesto.
Except, aren't you going to need more inspectors?
There is a challenge around recruiting and retaining inspectors, absolutely, and that's a conversation that I have had with the Chief Inspector. But I think if we can make reform of Ofsted happen, if we can refocus its work and make it somewhere that school leaders want to go and to be a part of, then we can succeed in supporting more people into those roles within Ofsted to combine their work as school leaders with work as part of inspection. And I know from speaking to school leaders that previously, given the system that we had and the culture that we had, they didn't always feel comfortable being a part of that. So the shift that we're seeing today is about standards, but it's also part of a wider reform in terms of how we move to a better system of accountability overall. Accountability is non-negotiable. We need to be confident that children are getting a great education, but we have to be better than this.
But the better system that you're talking about, it is going to be much more intensive, isn't it? If it's going to really give the kind of detail and accountability you're looking for. We heard from Amanda Spielman an hour ago, who said that as things stand, Ofsted hasn't been properly funded. If you're going to, I just want to be clear that you're confident that all of your plans, including the ones coming in a year's time, are you saying that all of your plans for the responsibilities of your department are going to be fully funded through the tax changes on private schools?
We will make sure, both through the tax changes and as part of the budget, and conversations are ongoing around that, as you'll understand, that we have the resources that we need in order to deliver a brilliant education for our children. Labour governments always prioritise education, and that is what you have seen from this Labour government, a real focus on making sure that education is front and centre of national life once more. And where it comes to the shift in the system that you just described there, absolutely, this will involve shining a light on areas that have not had enough attention in recent years where it comes to Ofsted inspections, the terrible rates of persistent absenteeism that we see in our schools, the need to ensure that schools are more inclusive, that they properly respond to the challenges that families are experiencing around special educational needs and disabilities, that we do not see practices like off-rolling within our schools. All of that will be considered as part of this revised system. But it is important as a part of that, that we move away from those reductive one-word judgments that I just do not believe should be part of a proper, strong accountability system.
When you've talked about absenteeism, you've pointed the finger at parents taking their kids out of school on cheap holidays. Now that you're saying as a government that you're going to act against dynamic pricing or high pricing on tickets, perhaps you should do the same with travel companies and airlines.
Look, I do understand the pressures that families are under, the fact that they want to take a holiday. And of course, we keep all of these areas under review. But there can be no good reason to take your children out of school during term time. It causes disruption to their education, but it also disrupts the education of all children within that class and within that school community.
Because
teachers end up having to repeat work, cover all ground.
Why not act on travel companies and airlines the same way that you seem to be prepared to do on ticket touts and ticket websites?
I agree it's an area that requires further consideration, but at the start of the school term, what I would say is that we all of us have responsibilities. We have responsibilities as parents to make sure that our children get off on a really strong start and are in school, because if we know that if children miss days in the first week, that sets a really bad pattern for the weeks to come and it leads to longer term absence. But absolutely, government has a role in this too, as do schools. We've got to work together, all of us, to buck this trend that we're seeing where one in five children are regularly missing time in school. That is causing lifelong damage to their learning, to their outcomes, and also from recent work that we've been able to publish, it causes lifelong damage to their earning potential as well.
I'm just really thinking you're not quite telling us whether you personally would like to see action that means that holidays are not cheaper outside term time.
Yes, it is an area that I would like to consider, but this is not what we're seeing here, really. This is a much bigger challenge in terms of the fact that, sadly, too many parents choose not to send their children into school on too regular a basis for reasons that cannot be justified or explained. And we, all of us, at the start of this new school term, have a chance to get off on a good foot. And that is the message that I've been sending to parents, but also to schools, to make sure that they are doing everything they possibly can to make their school community a welcoming environment for children and families. And government's got a role to play in that as well. And that's why we intend to deliver more support around mental health, but also to reform the system where it comes to children with special educational needs and disabilities, which we know just isn't serving the needs or interests of many of our children.
Bridget Phillipson, thank you very much. I meant to say not holidays, not cheaper in term time. I think I said the opposite.
I was focused on Ian McKellen, who's just turned up. I'm so sorry.
Fair enough.
I missed that last final moment. Ian McKellen has, we're told, just turned up, so the traffic wasn't that bad. We're going to hear from Ian McKellen, Sir Ian McKellen, in just a minute. But first, at 22 minutes past eight, Mike Williams is here with the sport.
He's just outside the door, isn't he, Ian McKellen? If you listen closely, you can hear his booming, theatrical voice. I've just said hello to him. Looking forward to hearing that. But let's talk football, shall we, briefly. Two fierce derbies, one shared emphatic scoreline yesterday. Liverpool beat Manchester United 3-0 at Old Trafford, whilst in Glasgow, Celtic were also 3-0 winners over arch rivals Rangers. Meanwhile, in Paris, we saw a record-breaking 12 gold medals for Great Britain on day four of the Paralympic Games, including for Hannah Cockcroft on the track in the 100 metres and for Maisie Summers-Newton in the pool in the 100 metres breaststroke. But let's look back now on an emphatic victory for England's cricketers at Lord's yesterday. Victory over Sri Lanka by 190 runs saw them win the match and the series with a day to spare. Moment of the match, though, undoubtedly came on Saturday.
He calls it out to the cover and Joe Root goes to 34 test hundreds. He jumps in the air, he raises his bat to the crowd. Everyone up on their feet to witness a man do something that no other England player has done before. We salute you, Joe Root.
He is quite simply England's greatest, and is absolutely right. He should have the record on his own. Take it in, Joe. We are watching a genius.
Universal acclaim for Joe Root after he hit a record 34th Test century on Saturday, more than any other England batter in history. A very proud day for the former captain and his family. And delighted to say that we can speak to Joe Root's dad, Matt Root, who joins us live on the programme now. Morning, Matt.
Morning, Mike. How are you?
Yeah, I'm great. How are you? You must have been the proudest man in Lord's on Saturday. Just put into words, if you can, your emotions on watching your son make history.
Yeah, very special day. I think, you know, he's worked really hard for it. I think one lesson to learn for any sort of young cricketer growing up is not to let things get out of hand. Keep things in perspective. Not let the highs get too high and the lows get too low. But 3,400 is pretty good achievement.
How did you celebrate as a family? All out for a meal Saturday evening, was it?
No, we're going to save the bubbles until after the Oval Test, I think, back-to-back test. So, you know, the players had a few quiet drinks together last night, but I think we'll all get together after the last test.
When did you first realise that Joe had something special? At what age did you realise that he could make it professionally, but did you have any inkling in those early years that he would go on to be this good?
Quite early on, actually. I mean, he was quite technically very sound, and so he started playing men's cricket quite early. But you know, as he said on interview with the BBC the other night, he found it difficult to penetrate the infield. So although he was technically very good, he had to find ways of scoring runs in unconventional areas, which he's very good at. But I think from about, you know, sort of 12, 13, you could tell he was probably going to make a career out of it.
We heard former captain Alistair Cook in commentary there. He is the man, isn't he, who Root overtook to claim the record of number of centuries. And it is now pretty much guaranteed that Joe will also go on to become England's highest run scorer of all time. He's just 96 runs away from breaking that record, also held by Cook, the 12,472 test runs, the current record. So more history for Joe and your family. But himself, Joe, it doesn't particularly take too much notice to this history, does he?
No, just to plough on. I mean, everybody's asking the question now, will he get past Tendulkar's record, which I think is about 15,900, if he goes past Cookie. But no, he just seems to take it in stride and just take every game as it comes, really.
And he's still only 33. Amal Rajan and I were just talking earlier off air, and I think Amal's got him playing for another decade or so. Not sure if he's going to go on to his, into his 40s, but he's certainly got several good years left in the tank, hasn't he?
Well, unless he were to spring a surprise on us and retire just now, I think that would be, which I think would be very unlikely. If his body holds out, I think he'll just keep going for as long as he can.
And six of these 34 centuries have come, haven't they, since Joe Root gave up the captaincy. Do you think that's a coincidence? Does he feel now unburdened, do you think?
No, I don't think so. I think, you know, I think his average was probably higher as captain than it was before he was given the captaincy. He had a phenomenal year when he scored, I think, 1,400 runs in one of the years as captain. So I don't think the captaincy had much of an effect on his run scoring, although I knew he did find it quite difficult with COVID and one or two other things. He's just enjoying playing now. You know, he really enjoys playing without the burden of the captaincy, and I think you can see that in his scores.
Well, congratulations from all of us again to Joe and the whole family on what was an incredible weekend, and could yet still be more records to come at the Oval, as Matt was saying there. Matt Root there, Joe Root's dad, after that famous day at Lord's on Saturday. Honourable mention as well, we should say, for all-rounder Gus Atkinson, who became only the third English player to score a century and take five wickets in a test, and the first since Ian Botham 40 years ago in 1984.
Fantastic start to his career. Mike, thank you very much indeed. It's 27 minutes past 8. So Ian McKellen is generally regarded by those who judge such matters to be among the greatest actors this country has produced. A Lancashire boy born just before the outbreak of the war, he's known to millions for his work on stage, particularly with Shakespeare, and hundreds of millions for his work on screen, particularly as Gandalf. His new film, The Critic, casts him as a gay theatre critic in the 1930s, long before homosexuality was legalised in this country, of course. But many of his fans feared his career would finally be cut short by a nasty fall on stage while playing Falstaff in a production called Player Kings in June. Luckily, he's okay and he's here. So, Ian, good to see you. How are you?
Luckily, yes, I am. I'm absolutely physically recovered, actually. I think I broke my wrist, which is what every kid who falls off his bike does, and that's all right now. Chipped a little vertebrae, left a bit with a few aches but not pains. It's emotionally that I've got some residue that I've got to deal with. It was I said to myself as I slid off the stage and tripped and slid on a polished surface. This is the end. These were the words of my mind. This is the end. And apparently I shouted out, my neck is broken, I'm dying. I don't remember saying that. So there was a lot going on in my head as the body responded to the fall, which was broken by the fact that I was playing Falstaff, who was a fat man, and I wore a fat suit to make me look fat. Padded, you see. No problem with my ribs or my hips, thank goodness.
Last time we
saw the extremities. So I'm taking it easy. But very nice to be here. And cricket, just hearing that, I was reminded the first big cricket match I went to, 1948, Australians versus England at Old Trafford.
Oh, a legendary test match.
And there was Donald Bradman playing.
But that wasn't Bradman's final innings, was it? Because that was at the Oval. But I think it was in that year that Bradman had his final innings.
Oh, was it? Right.
Yep. Didn't quite manage to get to a career average of 100. Could I just ask you, last time we spoke, you said that you speak, I mean, you're, if you don't mind me saying, 85, you think a lot about death. You've had lots of your friends have died. So in that moment, you really thought as you went over that this could be...
Well, apparently, I don't remember it, but I said it, apparently. So, yes, my it seemed to be the end of something. Well, it was the end of Falstaff, at least for the time being, because I couldn't, unfortunately, go back and do the tour, which I'd insisted on, that after London we'd go to, where we were going to, Bristol, Norfolk, Birmingham, and I hereby apologise at Newcastle, my favourite theatre in the country, the Theatre Royal Newcastle. And I couldn't go there, so...
Did your confidence take a knock as well? I mean, how are you feeling emotionally about it?
I think there's something inside me that has to be calmed down, but I'm feeling fine. I'm out and about, and up at this time of day, talking to you, what could be nice?
Because you're usually quite a late riser, as I understand
yes,
it. Let's turn to the new film. Now, what was it about your own decades in theatre and decades being a gay man in a country where it was illegal that first attracted you to the idea of playing a gay theatre critic for the 1930s?
Well, because the words had been written by Patrick Marber, who's a wonderful playwright and screenplay writer. I've worked with once before, and he sent me the script and said, this is the best part I've ever written for anybody. So I scarcely had to read it. I just said yes. And then it turned out to be a subject that I knew quite a lot about, obviously, a theatre critic. At a time when newspapers were extremely powerful, and a critic writing for a major newspaper would have a lot of power. We could make or break a career in a way that couldn't happen now, when everyone's a critic. And publishing their views usually before the professionals get at us. So he behaved extremely badly. I won't go into how that comes about, but he misuses his power and is quite cruel. And if you wanted to find a reason why that should be in a man who is otherwise extremely confident and witty and entertaining and good company, I would say if society is going to disapprove of someone to the extent of saying we will put you in prison for simply being what you are, namely gay, is it any wonder that that person might take some sort of unwitting revenge on other people for other reasons? I've seen that happen elsewhere. So it was easy to get inside the character, but wonderful lines of witty put-downs and so on. And, of course, when I got there, I realised I was working with some of the best actors around these days in this country. Mark Strong.
Gemma Arterton.
Gemma Arterton. Oh, what a joy. And Leslie Manville. And others right down the cast. It's a very special job.
What impact?
And all filmed in London, which meant I could sleep in my own bed at night, which is often a crucial point.
Famously lived just on the river. What impact for good and for bad have critics had on your career?
On the whole, beneficial, kind, overkind. I was at Cambridge University. I was doing Henry IV Part 2, which is the same play as that Falstaff is in. But on that occasion, I was playing old Justice Shaller, wonderful part. And the National Critics came down to review us. Now, this was the Marlowe Society, which doesn't publish names of the actors. It's all done anonymously. And this review said, I wish I'd known the name of this actor playing Justice Shaller because it'll obviously become a name to remember. Well, that's very heady stuff when you're 18 and you see that in print in a national newspaper. And I went into the theatre, the Arts Theatre, Cambridge, that night to do the show, and a friend said, well, I suppose you'll be getting an agent now. I said, an agent? What do you mean an agent? Well, actors need agents. Oh, you mean professional actors? And I could take you to the flagstone. It's still there. Every time I go to Cambridge, I go and stand on it. Where I decided, I'm going to try and become a professional actor. Like Derek Jacobi, who was also there at the same time and in that production. And John Tiedemann, who ran radio in this building for so many years. We were all at it, and they were all intending to become professional. So I gave up all thoughts of teaching or...
And a lot of people have benefited from it. A final thought, you've really given your life to acting, and above all, you spent most of your life actually in regional and community theatre. And if you think back to this country after the war, you've often spoken about how these little towns, you can't imagine those towns without a travelling theatre company. They were integral to it. How much trouble is regional theatre in now?
Well, those companies were not travelling companies, although there was plenty of touring theatre, which was productions that were coming to the West End and then leaving the West End. Most towns and certainly cities had a repertory company. That would be a company that would put on a different play every 2 weeks or 3 weeks or in some cases 1 week. And after the war, the government had realised that the arts, music and performance, dance of any sort, encouraged the national spirit. Perhaps our government should remember that. And in times of woe, the arts can be a way of reviving people's enthusiasm for life and community. And now all that has gone. But when I started out as an actor, it was easy. I could just apply for a job and got one at the Belgrade Theatre of Coventry.
Well, you're still here and still going strong. And it's wonderful to speak to you. The film, The Critic, is released next Friday, September the 13th. Sir Ian McKellen, thank you for getting in, getting through the traffic and coming to see us.
Lovely to be here.
Now, let us turn to something that is released on Radio 4 this Saturday, which is a new series of Political Thinking with Nick.
I was shouting at the telly and he was just got so fed up and said, either do something about it or shut up. And I said, well, I will.
250 editions of Political Thinking are available now on BBC Sounds. And this weekend, the new series begins on Radio 4.
I was raised in a trade union family. Both my parents were active.
Personal insights from the people who shape our politics, including health workers, sports stars, musicians.
I was entitled to have an opinion, but I needed to justify it.
The new series of Political Thinking with me, Nick Robinson, starts on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds on Saturday evening at 5:30.
A quick look at the weather today will bring heavy showers for many, while the risk of thunder will persist. Some brightness is likely for eastern areas of England.
You're listening to Today on Radio 4, where Tom Sanders has the news.
Ofsted inspectors will no longer rate state schools in England with single-phrase grades, such as outstanding or inadequate. The government has abolished the system, saying it wasn't fair or accurate, and a new report card system will be developed by next year. The Education Secretary, Bridget Phillipson, told us that a single word couldn't capture the essence of a school, and parents are capable of understanding a wider range of information. Thousands of businesses are expected to be closed in Israel during a strike aimed at putting pressure on the government to reach a deal with Hamas to free the remaining hostages held in Gaza. Sharon Lifshitz, whose 84-year-old father is one of the hostages, told us she believed the Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu had done a lot to sabotage a deal, but he insists Hamas is blocking an agreement. The German Chancellor Olaf Scholz has urged mainstream political parties not to lend support to the far-right Alternative for Germany, or AfD, after exit polls suggested it had made big gains in regional elections in two eastern states. The AfD is set to become the largest party in Thuringia and the second largest in Saxony. The NHS has started vaccinating pregnant women and older people against a respiratory virus known as RSV. Officials say the new jab could prevent thousands of hospital admissions during the winter.
Tom, thank you very much indeed. It is 48 hours since tickets for the Oasis reunion shows went on sale, and people have found themselves paying hundreds of pounds more than the £150 face value. This is on official ticket websites like Ticketmaster and Twickets, thanks to surge or dynamic pricing. The government says it wants to end rip-off resales. But the most eye-watering prices are on resale sites such as Viagogo, where this morning we spotted tickets for one of Oasis's London shows next year at a mere £7,084. Matt Drew is a spokesman for the company, for Viagogo, and is on the line. Good morning, Matt.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
Your site's out of control, isn't it?
Well, I wouldn't say that. We run a marketplace, so often people will list tickets at crazy prices, but frankly, those just don't sell. Think of us as a bit like eBay, but for tickets in many respects. So you might see a cheap headline for something like that, but most tickets are going at rational and reasonable prices. I would encourage fans to wait, let these prices settle down, and I think they'll probably find some good value closer to the event.
But they're taking a considerable risk, aren't they, by buying on sites like yours altogether. Oasis warned about that, saying only tickets via Ticketmaster UK or Twickets at face value were valid ones. They said any appearing on other secondary ticket sites are either counterfeit or will be cancelled by promoters.
Well, ticket resale in the UK is legal. It's a heavily regulated industry. Our platform is regulated. We've just got thousands of people into Taylor Swift concerts around Europe and the rest of the world. So we don't really believe that is a particular problem. Moreover, with our site and with our platform, there's a full guarantee. So to the extent that in the very, very, very rare examples that people do not get to access the event they've bought tickets for, they get either alternative tickets or they'll get their money back. So we don't think that is a significant issue. And we're very, very confident that we'll be able to get a number of well, many thousands of people into these Oasis concerts. And quite frankly, it feels like that solution is a requirement, given some of the chaos and difficulty we saw this week, this weekend. I was trying to buy Oasis tickets on Saturday. It was a horrific fan experience. And I think what we really learned this weekend is that the whole ticket ecosystem needs a comprehensive review and change is absolutely required, because fans just are not being served by what's in existence at the moment.
So does that mean that the statement Oasis made, tickets appearing on other secondary ticket sites are either counterfeit or will be cancelled by promoters? Is that not accurate?
Well, as I said, we've got a very strong track record of getting people into these gigs. We did it with Taylor Swift this year. We did it with Beyonce the year before. Yeah, we're getting fans around the world into these events. So we haven't seen that as a problem. And to the extent that there is a very, very, very small minority of people who don't get in, as I said, they're fully protected by the guarantee that we have. I think the biggest story here is what we saw this weekend in the primary market. So Ticketmaster and a couple of other sites had tickets for the Oasis concerts at point of sale for primary, with a very important distinction to make. That's the first offering of tickets. Resale comes after for people who didn't have the opportunity to buy those tickets. For example, you know, at 9 a.m. on Saturday, perhaps you're working, you can't get into that queue, or you just had to endure that horrific experience and didn't end up with tickets. We give people a second chance. I think what we really should be interested in after this weekend's events is what happened to those consumers in the primary market. You know, horrific queues, being kicked off the website, the crashes, being accused of being a bot. You know, this is a highly anticipated event. And frankly, it's a system that just isn't fit for purpose. And as a result, yeah, we think that some of the recent moves to look at the industry as a whole, and some of the comments, you know, for example, from Lucy Powell yesterday about the lack of transparency in this space are very, very valid. And there needs to be a focus on it. You know, think about being a fan and joining those queues on Saturday, having no idea really if more dates were going to be announced, having only one place to buy these tickets. A complete lack of competitive tension in the space means there's no downward pressure on those tickets. And it created an incredibly fertile environment for those ticket prices to go crazy in the primary market.
Okay.
Which, but, of course, gets us onto dynamic pricing and the issues that surround that.
Which the Culture Secretary says that the government is now going to be looking into. But isn't it still the case that anything sold at above face value on sites like yours is a breach of the original terms and conditions? UK Music has said that.
Well, as I said, I think there's evidence all around us, ample evidence all around us from gigs that take place around the world and in the UK every single day, that tickets that are transacted on our platform get people in. I think the issue that really is most interesting here is what happened with dynamic pricing over the weekend. Dynamic pricing in a closed environment where there's absolutely zero transparency, and when fans are getting to the point of checkout and being told that the price has gone up three times more than they anticipated paying, that is closed dynamic pricing. There is no competition there. And the effect of it is that effectively the fans have to pay any price that the primary seller is putting out there. You compare that with other examples of dynamic pricing in the taxi industry or in the airline industry, where there is open competition, there's multiple points of sale, that creates downward pressure on prices. That creates an environment where prices can go up and can go down.
OK, Matt Drew from Viagogo, thank you.
16 minutes to nine. What if we reconfigured our politics, indeed our whole understanding of the modern world, not on an axis of left and right, but through the prism of attitudes to risk? Something like this is the starting point for a new book by one of America's most celebrated pollsters and, more importantly, risk analysts. Nate Silver came to fame far beyond Washington for his uncannily accurate forecast of presidential elections. He was a founder of 538, an American website that focused on opinion poll analysis, politics, economics and sports blogging. He then wrote an international bestseller called The Signal and the Noise, and he's got a new book out. It's called On the Edge, The Art of Risking Everything. Nate, welcome to Britain.
Good morning. Thank you.
Good to see you. You say the world can to some degree be occupied by those who exist in what you call the river and those who live in the village. Who are they and how do they differ?
So the village are people who are maybe on a U.S. East Coast or frankly maybe in the U.K. Where it's more about the community. We're turning the dial down on risk taking quite a bit. More looking at life expectancy and not GDP growth, for example, the establishment. Whereas the river is Silicon Valley, it's Las Vegas, it's Miami, it's kind of the new world, so to speak, where it's people who take calculated risks for a living. Risk and reward, though, it's a place where you also see people like Elon Musk or Peter Thiel or Sam Bankman-Fried, for example.
So your basic idea is that the people who are winning in this world of acceleration, this world of extraordinary revolutionary technologies, are people who are prepared to take risks and generally take those risks well.
They don't always take them well, and there's downsides both for them as individuals and for society. But the fact is that we are in an economy where competition and capitalism tends to win out, for better or for worse. When we just had this segment on Oasis ticket pricing, right? And the market tends to find a way, whether it's in the best interests of fans or the industry or whatnot, in this kind of free market, that's what tends to prevail.
Do you offer advice in the book, you know, if there's not just a correlation, but a causal link between risk taking and success, do you offer any advice on how to take risks well?
I think people in their professional lives should take more risks, especially when younger. People tend to be happier when they change jobs. I've changed jobs myself a number of times. You know, people getting out of unhappy situations, moving across the country, getting out of an unhappy relationship. When you're young, then you have a lot of upside to gamble with. And I think we are not used to dealing with an environment of abundance. For many years, the human species were in a subsistence existence. And now we live in abundance and we can take a few more risks sometimes.
To what extent does this translate into politics? Because there's an argument that, you know, attitudes to risk have always been part of politics. You know, conservatives believe social goods are easily destroyed but not easily created, therefore they're kind of loss and risk adverse. So do you try and apply what you're saying to politics?
To some extent. I mean, I think the United States took a big risk in many ways when it elected Donald Trump now 8 years ago. Although this time you saw the Democratic Party take a risk in changing its candidate, replacing Joe Biden with Kamala Harris, who so far is polling quite a bit more close to Trump. And so that was a example, I think, of a smart, calculated risk.
The point about Trump is interesting because, in a way, there are lots of parties of the right around the world, some of them veering towards national populism, who've been more willing to embrace risk, who've been less the cautious conservatives of old.
I think there's a rebellion, too, against kind of the old way in an environment where the economy is not growing all that much, right? The deal used to be that, sure, we'll have this capitalist system, but the pie grows and everybody is better off. And you see in Europe, for example, that GDP growth has been quite flat for many years in many countries. And so you can understand, maybe not agree with, but understand when people are fighting over a fixed asset pool and people get upset.
I know there's a lot in your book about an area which our listeners are very interested in, which is our growing understanding of neurodiversity. To what extent does attitude to risk intersect with neurodiversity and our ever better, but still incomplete understanding of things like autism and ADHD?
Yeah, I mean, this is a discussion I think that we should have more in the open and celebrating people's different ways of looking at the world. People who are on the spectrum, on the one hand, tend to be less concerned about social cues. That means they might be more innovative or more willing to take risk in some ways. In other ways, they might be more neurotic and so forth. But if you combine people, so Elon Musk identifies as having Asperger's, but he's also extremely risk-loving and risk-taking. If you combine that willingness to gamble with indifference toward what society thinks, since that's a very high risk but also high reward skill set potentially,
and a preparedness to work extremely hard,
and the hard work. All the people in the book, the people that even the bad boys in the book, are people who work insanely hard and they keep gambling and doubling down even when they've already won. But the work ethic is quite insane.
The new book is called On the Edge: The Art of Risking Everything. Nate, it's really good to see you. Thanks for coming.
Absolutely, thank you.
It is 10 to 9, and it is a month since Ukraine's surprise advance into Russian territory in the Kursk region began. Now Ukraine faces tough strategic choices on its next moves, where and how to commit troops given the long front line of this war. Our Europe correspondent Nick Beek has been up to the Sumy region of Ukraine, the one which borders Kursk, to talk to new recruits and to look at those choices.
We've joined a Ukrainian military convoy. and we're heading towards the Russian border, moving along these dusty roads through one village after another that's already been scarred from Russian shelling. The windows in a lot of places have been blown out. Whole houses have been completely obliterated. All the civilians have been evacuated from here. And we're driving towards a new base that the Ukrainians have set up. This was in the aftermath of their lightning-quick incursion into Russian territory.
Under a canopy of thick forest, we meet troops who have just returned from Kursk. Among them, a platoon commander from the 22nd Mechanized Brigade, who goes by the call sign Storm.
The Russian soldiers who surrendered, we took as prisoners of war. The Russians who attacked us, we killed.
Do you know how long you'll be on Russian territory when you go back?
We are fulfilling an order. We'll be there as long as we are told to. If we have an order to move forward, we can get to Moscow.
It feels that in taking us here, Ukraine is trying to send the message that it's got no intention of giving up the Russian land that it gained so quickly, and that in fact it's digging in, setting up new bases like this one, and preparing more troops to cross the border into Russia. But it's a gamble.
A gamble because Ukraine is now fighting on yet another front, and the generals need to decide where to send the newest army recruits, either into Kursk or to defend the battered eastern front line at home. This is a training camp in the Chernihiv region that also borders Russia. The military, anxious that the location remains secret, asked us to view the footage we recorded, but did not have any editorial control.
Just looking around at the recruits who are being trained today, and most of them are in their 30s, a significant number over 40 and over 50. 2.5 years into this war, and Ukraine is desperate for troops on the front line.
For years, Rostislav worked as a driver in his home city of Odessa. Within weeks, he could be part of Ukraine's operation in Russia.
I think this is the right thing to do. Look how long they've been on our land. You can't just sit there while they're capturing our territory. What will we do then? Will we become their slaves?
There's training for launching rockets, grenades, and manning machine guns. After decades of working on farms and on building sites, it's a big change for these men.
Well, this is a simulation of a Russian attack. Their troops have just poured out of a couple of vehicles. The Ukrainian defenders are in trenches, and they're slowly, gingerly making their way round to take up a better position. All the while, the trainers are shouting at them, knowing full well that today is a rehearsal. They could be doing this for real on Russian soil in a matter of days.
Kyiv had hoped that Moscow would divert thousands of troops from the east of Ukraine to defend Kursk. But so far, that hasn't happened.
I want that the war begin to end.
Valentin tells us he's had a busy month recovering Ukrainian vehicles recently damaged or destroyed inside Russia. It's hard to assess the level of casualties that Ukraine has taken in its surprise operation. But everyone here, unsurprisingly, is backing the mission.
One man, Putin Vladimir Vladimirovich, is attacked. And what we have to do? We have only to defend our home.
President Zelensky is pleading with NATO allies to urgently grant permission to use foreign-made long-range missiles to strike further into Russia. But Western partners remain worried about provoking President Putin into a wider war. Rostislav, the new recruit from Odessa, is adamant Ukraine deserves more help.
The Russians can reach our territory with long-range weapons, and we don't have such a weapon to reach their territory. We can't stand this anymore. We would like to hit Moscow to end this dirty war. Children and civilians suffer. Everyone does.
A month after Zelensky's Kursk gamble, the initial morale boost of the incursion has faded away. A strategic dilemma remains, and none of Ukraine's next moves look simple.
That was Nick Beek reporting. 6 minutes to nine. Let's close the programme by turning our thoughts to Germany, where for the first time, the Alternative für Deutschland has won a state election. They've won in Thuringia, and it looks like they could come second in Saxony. This at a time when Chancellor Olaf Scholz's own popularity is low and his SPD party is struggling. Let's talk to Thomas Matusek, former German ambassador to the UK, the UN and India, and also Katia Hoyer, German-British historian, visiting research fellow at King's College in London and author of Beyond the Wall, East Germany, 1949 to 1990. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Morning.
If I could start with you, Katia, please, why is the AfD surging?
There's lots of reasons. I would say chief among them is a deep dissatisfaction in some parts of Germany that the, you know, basically the system as it currently is, the status quo, isn't working for people. Very high up on the list is immigration as an issue, and the AfD has basically recently called this the mother of all problems. They're trying to basically link all the other issues like housing, the economic crisis, and everything else basically to it. And that's a message that seems to have struck home, basically, particularly in eastern Germany.
And do you have a sense, Thomas Matusek, looking at them, that they actually have a coherent policy platform, or are they just riding a wave of grievance felt by many people?
Well, I think they're riding a wave of grievance. Whatever they try to sell as a platform is, of course, untested. They've never been in government. And it is very general and it is very anti. There are no positive ideas. But if I may, I would just add to Katja's reasons for the AfD one more point, and that is a general soft feeling in East Germany towards Russia. This unites the AfD and the new Sarah Wagenknecht Bündnis, a splinter party of the former left, with at the same time nationalists and communists. Let's stop weapons delivery to the Ukraine, urge negotiations, and then somehow, miraculously, the big Russian bear will be happy and we come back. And I think the Ukraine issue is also one of the main issues in Eastern Germany why people voted for AfD and PSW.
You mentioned, Thomas, that Sarah Wagenknecht party, this party, former communists, become very influential. German politics now is extremely messy, isn't it? It's about forming coalitions. And because everyone has said that no, they will not work with the AfD, this new party of the left, who people may be prepared to work with, could actually have a significant influence.
Oh, yes, they will have an influence. I mean, if you look at the CDU, they have made a decision that on the federal level, they will not go into any cooperation with BSW, but they leave it up to the several states. Now, Sarah Wagenknecht argues that Ukraine, which is not a state issue, but which is a geopolitical issue, is so important for her that she will make that a test for a possible cooperation. So the coalition negotiations, which you will see in Thuringia and Saxony, which will be extremely difficult, have to deal with this issue, which, of course, poses a major problem for the Berlin coalition.
And Katia Hoyer, why is Olaf Scholz so unpopular?
There are lots of reasons for that, I think, but chief among them is that he doesn't seem to commit to anything. I think he's seen as somebody who prevaricates, who tries to hold back for a while until he sees where the wind's blowing, basically, and that's been quite unpopular, I think, with a lot of people who want change and want change quickly. And I think the other reason is that the coalition that he leads is so unstable and so divided internally that people feel that, you know, whilst they want solutions for their day-to-day concerns, what they see in Berlin is squabbling. And that's something that Olaf Scholz is seen to be having sort of little control over. And I think that's another reason why he's so deeply unpopular.
Is Germany a bit stuck, Katja?
It is, because I think for too long there's been all sorts of excuses why people vote different ways. People have, you know, basically called people who vote for the far right party sort of Nazis and extremists, which, you know, given that it's had such a surge over the last year, I find difficult to believe, since, you know, there are real concerns behind these.